Good morning, everyone.
Yeah, there we go. I don't like being by myself.
This meeting is called to order November 4th, 2015 at 9:28. Before proceeding with any business, I believe Mr. Smith has a statement to make.
I do. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The public notice of this meeting containing all items on the proposed agendas has been filed in the Office of Secretary of State as required by Chapter 551 Government Code, referred to as Open Meetings Act. I'd like for this fact to be noted in the official record of the meeting. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Carter. Next order of business is approval of the minutes from the previous work session held August 19, 2015, which have already been distributed. Do we have a motion for approval?
So moved.
Moved by Commissioner Jones, second by Commissioner Scott. All in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? Hearing none, that motion carries. Next order of business is approval of the minutes from the previous annual public hearing held August 19, 2015, which have also been distributed. Approval by Vice Chairman Duggins.
Second.
Second by Commissioner Martin. All in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? Motion carries. Before we proceed, I want to announce that work session item number 10, grant of utility easement, Brazoria County, approximately 37 acres of the Justin Hurst Wildlife Management Area, has been withdrawn from the agenda. Our work session item number one, update on parks and wildlife progress and implementing the Parks and Wildlife Land and Water Resource Conservation and Recreation Plan. Carter Smith.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Commissioners, for the record, my name is Carter Smith. I hope everyone is doing well this morning. Hopefully you noticed a few changes in the lobby when you came in. Those wonderful pictures you may from Wyman Menzer, you may recall those from the 50th anniversary celebration of the department that was held in Houston. And so Josh and his team, namely Sonia Yek, have got those displayed proudly in the lobby. Make sure you have a chance to look at them. On the back hall, there's a great exhibit of magazine covers that were painted by Orville Rice, a famous wildlife artist back in the 50s, whose artwork graced the cover of a lot of outdoor magazines. So if you have a chance, take a look at it, and I want to compliment Josh and Sonia in particular for their work to help spruce up that lobby. As Sonia said, it now looks like us. So enjoy that. Also, I wanted to let you know, last night, the voters of Texas resoundingly approved Proposition 6, the right to hunt and fish. That is now enshrined constitutionally. We've become the 19th state in the country that has a constitutional amendment guaranteeing the right to hunt and fish. Maybe a couple of observations about that, if I could. One, it passed with flying colors. Over 81% of the people that voted in support of the constitutional right to hunt and fish. I think that's certainly consistent with all of the polls and research that we see about the public's strong support for certain types of hunting and angling. It's so nice to see that continue. Also, as we talked about prior with the commission, the bill sponsors and the legislators that moved that through the legislature to bring it to the voters worked very closely with the department on the language of that. So, to make sure that really that serves as more of an insurance policy down the road. There's not any immediate or practical implications or bearing of that constitutional amendment on the department. Obviously, the rights to hunt and fish are still subject to the rules and regulations that are put forth by this commission, brought forth by science, by your fisheries and wildlife biologists, and enforced by our game wardens. But anyway, we're pleased to see that pass again with such strong support from the public. I want to call your attention, at your place should be an annual report from our internal affairs team that John Gray put together. John did a great job summarizing last fiscal year's operations and describes some of the caseloads and the categories of cases, and then also some issues that he wants to make sure that we're all advertent to going forward. And so I'd ask all of you to make sure you have a chance to take a look at that. And if you have any questions about any facet of that report, please feel free to reach out directly to John or myself on that front. Also, as you will undoubtedly recall, at the end of August, Joe Carter retired. And so obviously sad to see Joe go after a very long and distinguished career as a state game warden with the department and also as our major in charge of internal affairs. John ably stepped in, is our acting director of internal affairs, and worked very, very closely, obviously, with our captains, Johnny Longoria and Brad Chappell, in the interim to manage that unit. And I want to thank John for his steadfast leadership during this time. He's done a terrific job to make sure that we didn't miss a beat on internal affairs related initiatives. We have also posted the internal affairs director position. That is open internally only. We feel like we've got a great pool of talent inside our law enforcement division, our state parks division, our internal affairs team. And so look forward to the applications coming in on that front. And obviously the plans is to get that position filled as expeditiously as possible. But I'll keep you posted on that front. But again, want to thank John for his leadership during this time. And also, again, just if you've got any questions about that report, don't hesitate to reach out to him. He's here today. Also, in your package there at place is an annual stocking report. Chairman, this is a great synopsis of the important enhancement and restoration work that our fisheries and wildlife biologists are doing all over the state to make sure that our hunters and anglers and outdoor enthusiasts are able to enjoy bountiful populations of fish and game. Again, the report is pretty self-explanatory. You get this every year, but you know, a couple of highlights. Coastal fisheries, you know, stocked over 30 million fingerlings in our bays and estuaries. Obviously, most of that are redfish and speckled trout. But the work on the culturing and propagation of southern flounder there at Sea Center continues to go on very, very strongly, and excited about the developments on that front and hopefully the expansion there in the future. Great, great innovation by that team there. And our inland fisheries team stocked 25 million fingerlings in 350 lakes and reservoirs around the state, including over 20 state parks. There's a great partnership there between inland fisheries and state parks to make sure that we've got sufficient fishing opportunities where possible in the parks. And on the wildlife front, you know, you'll read about familiar restoration efforts going on with eastern turkeys and pronghorn and bighorn sheep. But a couple things that I'll point out, one of which is a mule deer transplant project our biologists have been working on to transplant mule deer from Elephant Mountain Wildlife Management Area down to the Black Gap Wildlife Management Area and neighboring private lands, where the mule deer population still has really not recovered from drought-related impacts from the 90s. And so our biologists have done a great job on that front. Also, a new horn lizard restocking effort in which our biologists have been trapping horn lizards out in West Texas and releasing them there at the Muse Wildlife Management Area near Brownwood. And so a lot of great science going on that front, and obviously a strong public interest in the health of that species. So anyway, enjoy that report. And if you have any questions on that, feel free to reach out to Ross or Clayton or Craig or Robin, and they can certainly share more details with you. Y'all will undoubtedly recall that in 2013-2014, we received a petition from various individuals asking the commission to consider the prohibition of gassing as a tool for collecting rattlesnakes out in the wild. We had a lot of discussions internally and with the commission and with stakeholders and various members of the legislature about that proposal as we took a look at it from a science and management perspective. Chairman, you will recall that the direction we got from the commission was to charter basically a stakeholder group to task them at looking at a variety of things, including make sure that everybody had kind of a common foundation in the science, make sure we had captured information about the economic benefits of snake-related festivals throughout the state, looking at alternative means for collection and harvest and so forth. We appointed a working group chaired by Dr. Bill Eichenhorst, the chair of our Private Lands Advisory Committee, and that had roughly a dozen stakeholders that represented a variety of interests in this discussion, from the ranching community to snake collectors to herpetologists and others, to try to come up with some recommendations for us to consider about how to go forward. That group has been staffed very ably by John Davis from Wildlife and Kevin Davis from Law Enforcement. They've done a great job on that front, as has Clayton Wolf. They've held four meetings around the state. There's a lot of very diverse viewpoints on this issue, I think, as y'all are aware. I don't believe that the working group is going to be able to bring consensus recommendations to us, Chairman, but what they will bring to us is a history of their work and the process and discussions, and I think around a dozen to 14 items of consideration that ultimately they're going to want to make sure that the commission is aware of, again, with no real consensus around those, but at least things that the commission can consider. So once we get the final report, which we expect sometime in December, we'll share that, Chairman, with you and members of the commission, and then we'll seek your guidance as to what to do and what next steps on that front. Next thing I want to mention, obviously this Saturday, for really most of the state, 700,000 deer hunters, be the first time for them to be able to get out in the woods. Obviously bow season has been going on now for nearly a month, and obviously those landowners with managed lands deer permits have been doing some hunting. But again, for most folks, Saturday's a big day for the state in terms of the kickoff of deer season. And as you might imagine, our biologists have been very, very busy with surveys all over the state, working very collaboratively with private landowners on harvest-related recommendations. Our game wardens have been out working to make sure that they're enforcing all laws related to deer season and leading up to it. Hopefully you got the information on that case in Leon County that our game wardens made, a case that, you know, Craig described as probably the most egregious suite of crimes against wildlife that he's seen in his entire career. But again, emblematic of the important work our wardens are doing in terms of protecting our wildlife. Our communications team has been very busy making sure that they're obviously promoting the start of deer season this weekend and making sure that folks are also getting out there and doing that safely and responsibly and ethically and lawfully. And I want to comment a minute on hunter education, because that's an area that the commission has taken a lot of interest in and made working with our communications team some, you know, fairly substantive realignments with that program in terms of looking at the curriculum, compressing the time of the course, creating opportunities for expanded offerings for parents and children that wanted to go deeper in hunter education, but also for adults over 17, giving them an opportunity to be able to take hunter education online. And we've seen the fruits of those changes. Last fiscal year, roughly 72,000 hunters were certified in the state. Prior to that, we'd seen around 45,000, kind of in that range. So some very appreciable growth there. Again, I think making that program more accessible to people. Also, we were very pleased that in 2014, we only had one hunting fatality and 25 accidents among the 1,100,000 licensed hunters. Obviously, one is too many, but that was one of our lowest on records, and certainly 1 year does not a trend make. But, again, we're very pleased with the rollout of this. We also welcome back an old friend of Parks and Wildlife to lead our hunter education program in Steve Hall. Steve had retired from the department, gone on to other things, working for the Texas State Rifle Association and then on the national scale working on hunter education, really the international scale, but he's come back to Parks and Wildlife. We're proud to welcome him back to the team. Our Wildlife Division has really made it a priority, as you know, trying to maximize public hunting opportunities wherever possible for big game and small game, creating opportunities for hunters to be able to hunt on places with a $48 annual public hunting permit, but also through more managed drawn permit opportunities. And that's been a huge priority for the division, and certainly a strong direction from the commission to try to maximize those opportunities wherever possible. As you can see here by this slide, they're just doing a terrific job on that, and have almost, I guess, 237 hunting areas on the WMAs and state parks, but also leased private lands, which play a critically important role here and have exceeded their goal for the year. So we're excited about those trends and look forward to them continuing. And obviously we'll keep you posted on how that important program is going. That is a core program for this agency. 2 weeks ago, and Commissioner Martin was with us in Dallas to roll out the statewide monarch and native pollinator conservation plan with former First Lady Laura Bush. She hosted a big rollout of this plan at the Bush Library in Dallas, and we had the privilege of partnering with her, and Texan by Nature had the director of the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, Dan Ash, and the director of the National Wildlife Federation, Colin O'Mara, to come down to roll out the Texas Conservation Plan, working with trying to help reverse the very precipitous monarch decline. And couldn't be more pleased with that rollout. Our communications team, led by Josh, David Eichler from the EO, did a terrific job coordinating with all of our partners and pulling that event off. And our wildlife division put together a great plan that we've got for y'all, and please take a look at it. You know, just as a reminder, I think the beauty of this conservation initiative is really twofold. One, you know, this is a problem we can solve. And secondly, every single Texan has a role to play. It doesn't matter whether you live in an urban or rural area, if you're doing things in your backyard, your school ground, your church ground, your playground, your farm or ranch, there's a role that you can play in helping to recover monarch butterflies. And Texas plays, obviously, a pivotal role in this effort. And so we're excited that Texas is playing a leading role here. And obviously, this is an effort and initiative that's been well embraced by many across the state. Last thing that I want to mention, in October we announced the landmark settlement with BP on resolving outstanding claims on the Deepwater Horizon incident. As you will recall, that settlement resulted in a $20.8 billion payment from BP to the five Gulf states and various federal agencies to help, again, remedy damages to the environment and economies from that very tragic spill. About $1 billion is coming to Texas for projects to help offset environmental damage and economic losses. Really, the majority of that, I'd say roughly three-quarters of that, will end up going to environmental and conservation-related projects. We've talked very extensively with the commission in the past about that allocation between kind of the three buckets, the National Fish and Wildlife Foundation, which administers the criminal settlement part of this, and of which $203 million are allocated for Texas, and really those are for environmental restoration projects of resources that were impacted from the spill. The Natural Resources Damage Assessment Program, which is getting $238 million for Texas, which will again offset injuries to fish and wildlife and habitats, as well as lost human use. And so, for example, we're able to use some of that funding to help with rebuilding of Galveston Island and Sea Rim State Parks. It's a $150 million payment made to the state for economic injuries. And then there's roughly $400 to $450 million or so that's going through the Restore Act process, and that will be available for both economic and environmental-related projects. Other than the funds allocated to the National Fish and Wildlife Foundation, which are coming to the state over a six-year period, the funds from the other parts of this settlement will be spread out over 16 or 17 years, Robin, and so we'll see those come in over time. And so obviously we'll continue to play a substantive role there. I would be very remiss, so if I didn't highlight for the commission something that I'm not sure the commission is well aware of, and I'll take responsibility for that. When we had to engage in the Deepwater Horizon settlement, Texas Parks and Wildlife was the lead trustee for the state of Texas. So as you know, in these claims, we work with TCEQ and GLO, and we typically have a lead agency that works very closely with the others and the AG's office. And so Parks and Wildlife was the lead on that. And very quickly after we got into it, realized that was going to be a full-time job for somebody. And that somebody, after about 6 months, became Robin Rikers. And I want you to know that when we asked Robin to take that over on behalf of the state, he didn't hesitate. If he had known what he was getting into for the last 5 years, he would have hesitated. But I want to tell you, he has done a terrific job behind the scenes representing the state of Texas, doing an incredible amount of shuttle diplomacy between the five Gulf states, the federal agencies, working with the state agencies in Texas, the governor's office, many interested parties. He has been on the front line, literally, you know, 80 to 85% of Robin's leadership time has been spent representing the state on this, and I'm going to tell you, he has just done a fabulous job and could not be more proud of that. And Texas fared very, very well, in no small part because of Robin's leadership and work, and I want to thank him for that. It's just been extraordinary. Now, he's been supported by a lot of folks, Don Pitts from Inland Fisheries, really on the resource side, Joanna Gregory, Angela Schrift, James Murphy, an attorney that worked closely with Ann on this. Obviously, Ann's been intimately involved, Ted Hollingsworth on the land side. But I want you to know what a critically important role your team at Parks and Wildlife played, led by Robin Rikers, did to help make this possible. And so would be remiss to not brag on him. Mr. Chairman, Commissioners, with that, that is the sum and substance of my update, and be happy to take any questions you might have.
Any questions for Carter? Carter, thank you.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Item 2 is fiscal year 2015 internal audit update and fiscal year 2016 internal audit plan. Cindy Hancock. I'm good, thanks. Good morning.
For the record, I'm Cindy Hancock, Director of Internal Audit. I'm here today to update you on the completion status of the fiscal year 15 internal audit plan and any ongoing or completed external audits. In addition, I'll brief you on the methodology used in developing the proposed fiscal year 16 internal audit plan and provide the motion for adoption for tomorrow's meeting. This is a summary of the internal audit projects approved for fiscal year 15. The projects marked with C have been completed, and the reports have been issued. Since my last update in August, we've issued 4 reports: the travel advance audit, the data integrity audit, the state-owned housing audit, and the follow-up audit. The follow-up audit ended up this year with 34 recommendations being implemented and 38 are still in progress. To summarize some of the issues found in the recent audit, the travel advance account, policies and procedures weren't always followed in the administration or employee use of the funds, so we suggested that the Administrative Resource Division take a look at using the Citibank card, which could allow possibly a more efficient process compared to using the current petty cash account. For the data integrity audit, we examined the data within the Human Resource Information System and the Texas Fleet System. We found that the data integrity and accuracy could be increased through various process improvements. And for the state-owned housing charges, new policies and procedures need to be developed and written due to changes in the requirements of the General Appropriations Act. And an independent verification of facilities, occupancy, and rental rates should be periodically performed to ensure accuracy. We're currently in the field work stage for 4 projects. The dedicated funds, local state park grants, and field card audits are carryover projects from fiscal year 15. And we anticipate these to be completed in November through January. The fiscal year 16 follow-up audit has already begun, and it will continue throughout the fiscal year with the final report issued next September. In addition, we've already started the preparation for 2 of the fiscal year 16 fiscal control audits for the law enforcement offices in state parks. And the reason for that is they requested that we audit them during early and late winter, during their off-season period. We've not had any newly opened or recently closed external audits since my update to you in August. The Department of the Interior Office of Inspector General is still conducting their U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service federal grant audit. A meeting was held in late September where preliminary issues were discussed. However, the audit is still ongoing, and the auditors continue to request and receive documentation from staff. The federal auditors said that they expect the draft report to be issued sometime in December or January. Now, this concludes my first portion, my update portion of the presentation, and I'm going to give you a chance to ask any questions before I move on.
Any questions before we go into the plan?
I don't have any questions, but I do have a comment, and y'all are probably going to get tired of hearing me say that, but Keep in mind, I'm only on the board for another 2 years, so you only have to put up with this for another 2 years. But I just want to give kudos to Cindy and her staff, Don, Carter, and everyone that's helped make audit what it is right now. I know audit typically elicits a response of, oh, no, not another audit. Oh, no, you guys are just going to figure out what I did wrong. But I really do think that attitude has changed within the department. And now when auditors are seen, it's, okay, what can we do better? And that translates to the legislature such that they have confidence when they give us money that we're going to do with it what we said we're going to do, and we're going to be held accountable for it, and we're all holding each other accountable. So I know I keep saying that, but I would much rather say that than we have a problem and we need to fix it. So we don't have a problem. We have a good system, and turns out our system is so good it's being adopted by other state agencies. So I just want to give kudos not only to Cindy and her staff, but to the division leaders, so that when Cindy and her staff shows up in your division, Craig Hunter, you know, you don't freak out and go, oh, no, you guys are going to try to make me look bad in front of Carter and the board. That's not the way it works. And so we really do appreciate that, and we appreciate all the division leaders and your help to make this audit system what it is.
I appreciate that. Thank you.
Okay.
Well, it's that time again. The Texas Internal Audit Act requires that the audit plan should be developed using a risk-based approach consisting of executive management's review of agency functions, activities, and processes. The risks should be ranked on their probability of occurrence and impact to the agency in the financial, managerial, compliance, and information technology areas. Starting in September, I compiled fiscal year 15 financial and other agency information into a risk workbook. I then sent the risk workbook along with questionnaires or surveys to 129 staff, including executive management, division directors, and other key personnel. The surveys are structured to obtain top concerns within each division, agency-wide, external to the agency, as well as concerns regarding information technology systems and fraud, waste, and abuse. 25 staff responded, and these concerns were scored and ranked based on the responses, creating a list of top concerns. Once the responses were scored, I sent the top concerns to executive management and Commissioner Jones to be scored as to their priority. Once prioritized, I estimated the work hours needed to complete each project and compared it to the total number of audible work hours available to our audit team. I then sent the proposed audit plan to you for comment. The plan will be finalized upon commissional approval, hopefully tomorrow. There were three areas that I want you to be aware of that were ranked as high-risk categories during the initial staff survey but fell into the lower priority ranking in the later scoring process. Because internal audit has a set number of staff and available hours for audit work, three areas were not able to be included in the fiscal year 16 audit plan. These areas not included had to do with agency and division budget process, IT project performance, and emergency radio communications. And the reason I'm making you aware of this is that we have to disclose this on our audit plan when we send it to our oversight agency. The final results of this risk-based approach is the proposed fiscal year 16 internal audit plan, which is included in your books in Exhibit A. The plan shows our fiscal year 15 carryover projects and our new proposed projects for fiscal year 16. This exhibit also includes the number of hours estimated to complete these projects, and also it includes an alternative project that can be substituted or added if time permits. So this is the motion I'll be asking for you to adopt tomorrow for the approval of the fiscal year 16 internal audit plan, and I'll be happy to address any questions.
Cindy, thank you. Any questions on the plan? Okay, appreciate it. Thank you very much. Appreciate all your efforts. If there's no further discussion, I'll place the fiscal year 2016 internal audit plan on the Thursday Commission meeting agenda for public comment and action. Item 3 is 2016-17 Statewide Recreational and Commercial Fishing Proclamation Preview. Morning, Ken.
Morning, Commissioners. My name is Ken Krasowski, the Inland Fisheries Division, and I'm here today to preview some of the regulation, potential regulation changes that we've been discussing among our staff. First category is evaluation of some of the existing regulations and removing some unneeded regulations. First is on Nelson Park Lake, a small lake in Abilene. We put a catch and release regulation for largemouth bass there in 1992, and that was part of an effort to manage bass in small impoundments. That wasn't, at least in this instance, wasn't a successful regulation for the lake. It still has a pretty minimal bass population, suffers some low water quality. So we're just going to remove that special reg and revert back to the statewide bag limit for largemouth bass. And Meredith Reservoir for smallmouth bass, that had an excellent smallmouth bass population. Unfortunately, the low water levels and really golden alga there have decimated the smallmouth bass population. We also had a good walleye population there that was greatly impacted there. And since that population has been decimated, we no longer need that special slot limit on there, so we're going to it'll revert back to the statewide limits. If the reservoir does rebound and we wish to reestablish smallmouth bass population, the 14-inch limit would be a good limit for that starting out. And for sawguy, we're stocking this walleye-sauger hybrid in the 90s. Some states have had success stocking these fish and preying on sunnet crappie populations. We tried that in about 10 reservoirs around the state. Didn't have a lot of success with it. We did develop a decent population in Kirby Lake, in Kirby near Abilene, but the anglers seemed to have a difficulty catching the fish that were out there. We disbanded that program. We last stocked the fish in 2011. We had to get those fish from other states. It was difficulty getting them, so we're going to remove that special regulation, the 18-inch minimum on that, and just combine with the walleye regulation. And moving on to modify some existing regulations, Lake Nacogneish was opened in 2012 with an 18-inch minimum five-fish bag, which is the typical regulation we impose on new reservoirs, and the goal there was to protect those 14 to 18-inch bass and establish a decent population. The bass population is still developing in that reservoir. The staff there still thinks the trophy potential is high. Many times in new lakes, there's good growth, and we see that strong year classes and good growth starting out. After it was opened, we did do a creel on the reservoir. We did see that there was high effort. A lot of fish catch rates were high. Not much harvest, but we did see some harvest of those fish over 18 inches. And staff thinks we could further enhance that population and look at some of the other trophy aspects of it. We did put out an ask the anglers that fish the reservoir their opinion on some possible trophy regulation possibilities, and we asked their opinion on some of the regulations that we use for trophy fishing, and 16-inch maximum is the one that the anglers seem to prefer, and staff believes that has some good potential for the reservoir, so our proposal there is to implement that 16-inch maximum length limit in five-fish daily bag, and that means 16-inch maximum, you can't harvest any fish over 16 inches. But if you did happen to catch a fish over 24 inches and it exceeded 13 pounds, you could retain that fish and donate it to our Share Lunker program. We have a couple of reservoirs there, Nacogdoches and Kurth. It was near Lufkin that we have this reservoir on, and it seems to be well accepted by the anglers in that area. And what we're hoping to do there is maximize really the trophy production of those fish over 16 inches while allowing some harvest to get a little bit of turnover in the population, give some of those harvest-oriented anglers some fish to catch. Moving on to in East Texas, We have our coastal estuaries there have bass populations. Typically, the fishing there has been locally based and reasonably limited. There's a few small tournaments, mostly just small groups of weeknight jackpot tournaments. We have been looking at that at those areas over the years. We did some electrofishing in 2000, and we have done some stocking of Florida bass. We did some of that in response to the hurricanes, the saltwater intrusion into those areas, usually as a negative impact on the bass populations. These are some of the areas that we've been looking at down there, the lower Neches and Sabine and some of the attendant bayous in and around the Port Arthur area. And there's been some increased tournament interest in some of those areas, kind of unique fisheries. There was a Bassmaster Elite series there at a couple tournaments, and there have been a number of high school and college events. What they found and what we knew, that there was a low abundance of bass over 14 inches. We've always known that those populations down there responded and were a little bit different than many of our statewide populations. And there's also been a local desire in and around that area to recruit more of these tournaments into the area. And they felt that the lack of fish over 14 inches was a detriment to that. On the recent legislative session, there was a bill introduced that would allow participants in high school and college fishing tournaments to weigh in fish 2 inches below the minimum length limit, and it covered quite a wide area there, all the way down the intracoastal into Chambers and Gallatin County. We had some discussions with the representative that offered that up. The bill did not advance, but we did make a commitment to continue to examine the population dynamics in those systems, and also to get some angler input on maybe some possible regulatory changes. When we looked at our staff there did extensive work this year to look at the current state of those bass populations, and what we found were a lot of fish below 13, 14 inches. As we knew, not many fish were being caught over 14 inches. And there was a couple other things that are a little bit different. There's quite high natural mortality in that area, even though the condition of the fish, that relative weight, which we like to see around 95 to 100 was good. The fish natural mortality was still high, and growth was slow. Typically, it was taking them almost 4 years to reach 14 inches, and some of the other reservoirs around there, for instance, Sam Rayburn, takes 2 years. Toledo Bend, about 2.9 years for them to reach 14 inches. So this was a slow-growing population with not many fish over that 14 inches. We looked around the south and looked for some similar systems. That Chafalaya Basin had a similar situation. Bass were growing slower than the statewide averages there. They also had high natural mortality, and in the Louisiana, they decided to remove the length limit there. Another similar system in Alabama, similar, a few large fish, and they did some bioenergetics modeling, and they felt that the salinity and contributed to the slower growth. Also, there were some prey availability things due to the saltwater estuarine areas that were impacting the growth of bass. So what our next step is there, we're considering reducing the bass length limit, either a 12-inch minimum or possibly a no minimum length limit. We would retain that 5-fish bag. We're still considering what the boundaries of that, and we're in the process of doing a survey of the anglers in that area to see what they think of some possible regulatory options, and we're continuing to work with the representative's office, keep them informed what we're considering in this situation. And finally, we have on Lake Tuwakini, we have an excellent catfish fishery there, that currently being managed under the statewide length limits. There's been some just excellent catches of catfish there, large, mainly blue catfish, and we're hearing some desire among the anglers there to reduce the harvest of these catfish over 30 inches and provide some more additional harvest below 20 inches. As you know, we've been working on a catfish management plan, which is coming out soon, and some of the outcomes of that plan is when we talk to the catfish anglers around the state, we knew and the survey confirmed that our catfish anglers are harvest oriented, but also there's a desire there also to be able to at least catch some larger catfish. The trophy aspect is becoming a little more important. They'd like to harvest some of them, but above all, they'd like to be able to have the opportunity to catch some of those. So we're looking at taking that into consideration on this fishery. This fishery developed from one stocking of a blue catfish in 1989. That's typical of some of our reservoirs where we stocked a blue catfish. One or two stockings will develop some pretty excellent populations. Sometimes it takes a little while, but they usually do develop. And in combination with the blue catfish and the channel catfish, this area got declared the catfish capital of Texas earlier in the 2000s. As I said, there's been some just excellent catches of large fish, and some of the anglers are concerned about that, and our staff has been looking at that, and they're concerned that could this trophy fishery be sustained at that level. So they did some extensive special sampling in 2013 to assess that fishery and to try and get some information on that population. And what we saw comparing the harvest from creels, the angler's creel, over a couple periods, 2008 to 2009, we did see a pretty large increase in the number of fish harvested. That the number is the number we actually saw in our creels, and the TH, which is total harvest, is sort of a projected harvest over the entire fishery. And we also did see an increase there in those fish over 20 inches over that period. And we've been kind of focusing on the fish from 20 to 30 inches. The 20-inch fish there is about 3 pounds, takes about 9 years, and the 30-inches takes about 11 years to, they're about 11 pounds and about that same amount of time to get to that size. So we also, taking this information, we went back out to the anglers to get their opinions on the fishery. We saw that most of the anglers were satisfied with the current limits, but there was some support there, a fair amount of support for reducing the harvest of those large blue catfish. So some of that concern that we were hearing did get borne out in the survey. And there was a strong support for reducing the harvest of those larger fish for more opportunities to catch large fish in the future. And I make a distinction here between the harvest and the catch. The catch includes harvest, but catch can also include catch and release. So the anglers, what they were saying is they want to be able to continue to have the opportunity to catch those fish, but not necessarily harvest all of them. And they also were interested in keeping more small fish in exchange for reducing some of the harvest of the small fish, and that's an important component of this to continue to provide some harvest.
You meant reducing the harvest of the big fish?
Yes. So what we're looking at that, we used a model to model some of the impact population dynamics, taking the age and growth information, the mortality information, and population abundance. And we tried to look at those 20, 30-inch fish under various regulation scenarios to see what were the trade-offs if we limit the harvest of the various size groups of fish that are present in that populations. And our goal there to maintain or increase the catch of fish of those large blue catfish over 30 inches, and then really have a minimal impact over harvest overall by redistributing the catch. And what the option we're considering, staff's considering now, is removing the 12-inch minimum length limit. We're going to retain the 25 fish daily bag, but we're kind of proposing a new method for the composition of that 25 fish bag. We would allow the harvest of 7 fish over 20 inches, but then further limit that only 2 of those can be 30 inches to try and to redistribute that harvest among the size groups that we're looking to impact to maintain the good fishing in that population. Blue catfish are really the main focus of this. Most of the channel catfish are less than 20 inches. Anglers are pretty satisfied with that fishery, and that won't be impacted much by this regulation. And our rationale is to, we're trying to address the concerns about the harvest of those big blues by redirecting that harvest to some of the more abundant size classes and looking to maintain or increase the number of fish that could be caught in the coming years. And the next step here, we want to go back out and discuss this with the anglers. We recognize that this is a little, certainly a different wrinkle on our regulations, and we need to get some input to see if anglers are feel this would be a worthwhile step to take. And with that, I'd be happy to entertain any questions.
Questions for Ken? Commissioner Scott?
Ken, if you go back to the slide or the picture one that you got that showed salt water, the slower growth in the fish and everything, where you got Lakes Bay and Lower Neches River and Taylor Hildebrandt.
The map?
Yeah, the map. Right. Well, okay. If you look on that, look on the Lower Neches River one, I'm sure you're aware of this, but, you know, when you go up the Neches River and you get to Beaumont, and then you see I-10 where it goes from Beaumont to Vider,
right.
And, you know, right above there on the LN, on the Neches River, they built that saltwater barrier. Gosh, I guess Ampson was congressman when it got passed, so it's been at least 10 years. I'm just curious, because I had a nephew that was on that board, and it's pretty amazing the salinity levels from that saltwater barrier down to Sabine Lake, how much difference there is. And I'm just curious, you're not hardly very far above I-10 on this model, and I'm just curious why you didn't go further up to get the ramifications of the difference in the salinity, because it's a truly an amazing statistic, because they've actually got redfish now all the way up to that saltwater barrier, because the salinity goes all the way from Sabine Lake up to that. And nobody really understood how much difference in the salinity was until they built the barrier. And I'm curious on your model.
Well, I guess the outline here is just to focus of the areas that we've been looking at. We haven't, as far as settling on where we would draw those lines, we haven't settled on that. It would be certainly expanded possibly through the entire county.
I'm just curious if that affects anything that you're looking at doing or proposing or anything. I'm just curious how that would impact, you know, because it is such a huge difference in the bass fishing and everything above that saltwater barrier is
right,
dramatically different.
Correct, and people are moving in some of those currents. They were moving over those barriers, fishing various sides. So we need to consider that when we do make that regulation. Take a look at our population information and how far out it is. So where the people are going. So
yeah, I just wanted to...
yeah, that wasn't really representative of where we regulation would be. It's just to kind of focus those areas that we had been sampling in.
Okay, thanks.
Right. Commissioner Jones.
The regulations that you're proposing, I think I understood this correctly, apply both to the Blues and the Channel?
Yes. Our regulations are, for those that are always combined, it's a combined bag on the Blues and Channel catfish.
Got it. So it doesn't matter whether you caught a Channel or whether you caught a Blue, you got the limit of 2 above 30?
Right. Okay. Most of the Channels, there are very few above 20 inches. That's why this regulation, it would impact mostly... that 20 and 30 inch would just impact blues
more than any.
Right.
Okay. All right.
And Commissioner Duggins?
Would you pull up the slide? I think it's right. Keep going. It's current bass population status. It's got the WR. And what are the diamonds signaling?
That just represents the relative weights of those inch groups of fish. So, for instance, they're in the 90 to 110 range for the relative weight, and that's just a measure of condition, sort of the plumpness of the fish, of an index that we use to determine, fish that wouldn't be in good condition, wouldn't be growing well, skinny, would be down around 80.
Well, I understand it, but if you look at the fish in the, looks like the 6 to 10 inch group, they've got great WRs.
Yes, and that's what we did. That's overall the fish are in good condition there, but they aren't.
But then they drop down as they get bigger. Is that due to a lack of bait fish, or just too much competition because there are too many small fish?
I guess from that study in Alabama. They saw some.
What do they know?
In estuary conditions, some of the things that they were preying on, they didn't seem to be getting as much benefit when they got to the larger size. It was sort of a bioenergy. They were eating them, but they weren't getting much. You know, there was enough to keep them in good condition, but it didn't contribute to their growth. So.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Ken. Appreciate it. Any other questions? Jeremy, Coastal Fisheries, please.
Good morning, Commissioners. For the record, my name is Jeremy Leitz with the Coastal Fisheries Division, and I'm here today to talk about our division's potential changes for 2016-2017. And really all we have before you today is to clarify a regulation for black drum on the recreational side related to the maximum length limit. Right now, on the recreational side, black drum have a 5-fish daily bag. There's a 14-inch minimum length limit. You can keep one over 52 inches as well. Additionally, since about the late 1980s, there's been a 30-inch maximum length limit associated here. But just recently, when our administrative code was switched from a table format for bag and possession limits to a text format, that maximum length limit got eliminated in the process. It's still up on our website. It's still in the outdoor annual. It's still in our bag and size limit cards. It was just omitted accidentally from the administrative code. And so what we're doing is proposing to just put that back in this time, back to the 30-inch minimum length limit. And that's what we have this year, and I'd be happy to address any questions you might have.
Any questions? Okay. Thank you very much.
Might I ask just an unrelated question? It's related, but it's unrelated to black drum.
Okay.
I went fishing down at the coast during a red tide that we had not that long ago, and, and as I understand it, red tide only comes in once every 4 years, 5 years. It's infrequent, but when it happens, it's pretty awful. Do we have any data, or do we do any studies of the effect of the red tide on the fish population and whether we should or should not do anything as a result? Or does nature pretty much fix itself and we just kind of leave it alone and let it go until the next red tide rolls in?
We certainly have staff that do look at that. I may look to Robin here a little bit as well. But there's certainly a large group of people that look at that, and we do, you know, study the fish kills, the counts of the algae systems in the water. But in regards to specific studies on impacts of species,
Yes, sir, Commissioner. Robin Rikers with the Coastal Fisheries Division. What we do is we do our routine normal sampling that we do, and when we have these bigger events, we can, especially when they've been of real consequence, we've been able to pick those up in our surveys in regards to our bag seines and our gill nets, and we can then follow that through time. Now, as far as each individual spill, when it reaches the size of this event, we try to do fish counts to determine the overall kill rates associated with different species. And then, you know, as we move through time, we then look at that in comparison to those routine studies that we do. Yeah.
Okay.
So we try to measure that impact in the ways that we have, both for the event itself as well as through the time series of data that we collect.
Okay. I'll talk to you more about that offline. And I just wanted to know if we did stuff, because there were a lot of fish sitting on top of the water.
Sure. And most of the time it impacts rough fish and bait fish, but certainly you'll see some other sports species in that mix of species as well.
Yeah.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
I think we're going to start with Alan Kane for session item number 4, 2016-17 statewide hunting proclamation preview.
Morning, Mr. Chairman, Commissioners. For the record, my name is Alan Kane, Whitetail Deer Program Leader. This morning, I want to brief the commission on possible changes to the whitetail deer regulations. First change staff are considering is the elimination of the antlers deer control permit. And under the ADCP permit, a person may harvest does and spikes from September 1 through the end of February. The ADCP permit was started in 1993 and was very popular up until 2003. And then in 2004, we saw a sharp decline in permit requests and usage, and that's continued to today. In the last 4 years, we've issued only 4 ADCV permits and 3 this year to date. The decline in 2004 coincided with some changes to the MLD program where we extended the season for MLD to the end of February, and we did away with the dual tagging requirements that at one time you had to have a hunting license plus MLD tag or a bonus tag and MLD tag, and so we did away with that. And it made the MLD program more attractive, so consequently those folks under the ADCP program, permit program, a lot of them moved to the MLD program. And with that in mind, and the decline, staff are considering discontinuing that permit. And by doing so, that would help eliminate a significant expense that would be required to incorporate ADCP administrative changes into the TWIMS redesign. We go forward to redesign it for MLD. Additionally, there's no demand for the ML or ADCP permit, as you can see from the graph. And those individuals that have, the only 3 of them now that have the ADCP, one of them we've talked to, and he said he would move to the MLD program if this changed. And the other 2 obviously would have the option to move to MLD or Triple T or TTP to handle their harvest needs. Another change staff are considering is amending the definition of a legal buck during special late season. Currently, there's 136 counties in the state with the special late season where you can harvest a doe and spike, and that's the common what folks refer to that is. However, it can be confusing to a lot of hunters out there that are hunting in counties where there's antler restrictions in place. And for example, in general season in an antler restriction county, a legal buck is one of the legal bucks that a person may harvest is a deer with at least one unbranched antler. So you can see from the photo, obviously a spike would be legal. It's the photo on the right. And then on the left is a picture of a 3-point. He's got a little fork, and so that would be legal. However, when a special late season opens, the only buck that would be legal would be the spike buck, and that creates confusion for those folks in those antler restriction counties as far as what's legal as you switch what the definition is, especially relates to unbranched antler type deer. Therefore, staff would consider amending the legal buck to include any buck with at least one unbranched antler during that special season. Obviously, it would help reduce confusion among hunters, and especially in those antler restriction counties, and possible unintended violations. Regardless of whether you're in an antler restriction county, you could be hunting in South Texas, think you're shooting a spike, and you get up there, and he's got a little fork, and you'd be in violation. So this would kind of clean up some of that and help remove some of those unintended violations. Additionally, it provides some consistent regulations with the definition of a legal buck in our antler restriction counties. And if you recall, it's also consistent with the new MLD changes where under the harvest option, a person may harvest an unbranched antler buck with a rifle during that early season in October. Additionally, staff are considering opening a deer season in 14 counties in the western part of the Panhandle in Texas there. Over the last several years, staff are noticing an increase in deer density in that western portion. The counties outlined in blue on the screen there is we'd be considering expanding or opening a deer season too. We're also receiving requests from private landowners over there for the opportunity to harvest whitetails as they move into that area there. And traditionally, that's mule deer habitat, but whitetails are expanding westward from Lubbock all the way over to the New Mexico border there. And it does provide flexibility for these landowners to manage the expanding deer population. So what staff would be considering is for the counties in blue, we consider an archery in general season with a bag limit of 1 buck and 2 antlers. And then for the county in green, which is Winkler County, we consider an archery in general season with a bag limit of 1 buck and 2 antlers for all seasons combined, but antlers could only be harvested during the archery season. And the reason it's different is because the counties that surround Winkler there have that same bag limit and structure. In other words, you can only harvest antlers deer during archery season, and so we keep that consistent with those counties around Winkler there. Additionally, staff are also considering an expansion of doe days in 23 counties in the Post-Oak Savannah Ecological Region. in that region. Also, we're experiencing an increase in deer density. I think over the last 10 years, we've seen a 23% increase. Antlers harvest comprises about 40% of that region's of the harvest, the total harvest in that region. Obviously, harvest is skewed towards bucks, and as a result, we're seeing skewed doe to buck ratios up there, ranging from 3.5 does per buck up to 6 or so, depending on the particular area within that ecological region. Additionally, we've seen a 50% increase in MLD participation rates over there, especially in the last 6 years. I had one biologist tell me in the last 4 years he's gone from 3 properties in one particular county up to 47, and so obviously that contributes some of the workload issues we've talked about in the past with MLD. So expanding doe days in those counties would reduce impacts, deer browsing impacts on the native habitat out there, help to improve the sex ratio, provide some additional hunting opportunity, and provide some flexibility for landowners to manage deer populations over there. And so what staff would be considering is, so the counties on the map that are in orange with the dark brown outline, currently they have 0 doe days. We would consider opening those up to 4 doe day season in those counties. And then the counties in green with the dark green boundary currently have 4 doe days, and we would consider expanding those to 16 doe days. Additionally, in that post-oak savanna ecological region there, we'd also consider the expansion of a muzzleloader season that's depicted by the counties in blue on the map. Currently, there's a muzzleloader season that spans most of the eastern part of the state and down to the Oak Prairie region, and so we'd fill in and make that consistent with the rest of that region over there. And the muzzleloader season opens the first Monday following the first Sunday in January and runs for 14 consecutive days, and it generally coincides with the special late season in the rest of the state. So most of those counties in white doesn't have a muzzleloader season, but it does have a special late season for the doe and spike harvest, with the exception of a few counties in the panhandle over there. And the last change staff are considering has to do with antlers harvest on U.S. Forest Service lands. Under current rule, antlers deer permit is required to harvest an antlers deer on certain U.S. Forest Service properties during any season. And over the last several years, we've had requests from the U.S. Forest Service to exempt youth hunters during the youth-only season from that antlers permit requirement. And so staff would consider allowing for the take of antlers deer without an antlers permit on U.S. Forest Service lands during any youth season. So both on the front end, just that weekend before general season, and then on the back end, that week-long youth season there. It would provide additional harvest opportunity for the youth out there, and we don't see any biological implications to that. And it would be consistent with our policy and practice on our WMA properties that we lease from the Forest Service, where we do exempt youth hunters from a permit requirement during that youth-only season. So that concludes my portion of the statewide preview. I'll be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Alan. Questions for Alan? Mr. Douglas.
Alan, if you go to your chart that shows the counties where you're thinking about recommending expansion of that one. I think that last year, or maybe it was 2 years ago, when we looked at expanding the whitetail hunting in Lynn and Terry counties, or one of the two, or could have been both, we had a number of landowners there around Tahoka have expressed some real reservations and concerns, and we backed off from a safety standpoint than anything, given the nature of that terrain. Am I remembering that right?
It may be mule deer that we had the concern over, and I'm not sure. Sean Gray, our mule deer program leader's in here. He might be able to speak to that.
All I'm suggesting we do is, before we move too quickly on that we make sure we connect with the landowners up there who did express concerns last time, so that they're in the room and and able to share their comments early on, would be my suggestion.
Yeah, certainly we can do that and provide some scoping meetings up there to get some public input. So, Sean, do you have any, you recall?
For the record, I'm Sean Gray. I'm the Mule Deer and Pronghorn Program Leader. Yes, you're correct. It was for trying to open a mule deer season in Linn County. And we did get a petition that a lot of the landowners or folks in the community did not support opening a season at that time. But we are actively talking to them now, hopefully in the next year to propose Linn County for mule deer season. And we're getting more support for that, for sure.
Well, I would just suggest that we talk with those who signed that petition. One name that comes to mind was Crawford Edwards, whose family has a large ranch there at Tahoka. And I'm not suggesting that whatever he wants, he gets by any, I don't mean to suggest that. I'm just saying let's talk to people like him because they did have serious reservations last time.
Sure. Great idea.
What, remind me, what was the safety issue? What was the...
I think the issue in that area is you've got really a lot of farm country interspersed with little pockets of mule deer habitat, and those farm roads tend to get driven by a lot of people. And so I think there was a concern about enforcement and maybe pockets of habitat getting poached under the pretense of hunting. And so I think Sean and his team are doing a great job talking to those ranchers about that, obviously engaging our game wardens to make sure that we've got appropriate law enforcement presence. But I think that's what it really was about, all that open farm field and a lot of folks driving on those farm fields and then having, again, little pockets of cover where the deer will concentrate. Concern about vulnerability there.
Okay.
Thank you. Thank you.
Kevin Davis.
Good morning, Mr.
Good morning.
Chairman.
How are you?
Commissioners, for the record, my name is Kevin Davis, the Law Enforcement Division. Let's see, we got the wrong slides up there.
Oh, did we?
Okay.
All right, I've got Kevin first and then Dave Morrison next, but we can, whatever.
Did you have anything on the statewide, Kevin, or is your stuff on the aerial permits?
It'd be on the aerial.
So, oh, okay. Yeah, let's go back. Could we, sure. Mr. Chairman, go back to Dave Morrison and we'll get Kevin up.
All right, we're going to okay. Go to Dave and...
Thank you.
Get Kevin up here.
Sorry about that.
Yeah, it's all good.
Yeah, sorry about that.
Good morning. Chairman, commissioners, my name is Dave Morrison. I'm Small Game Program Director. And this morning, even though we just finalized the waterfowl regulations back in August, it's time to once again begin the process of setting federal state regulations for federally protected species. And we're going to be talking about the 2016-17 migratory game bird for next year. And primarily the purpose of this briefing is to provide you with an update on the new process and timelines. As we mentioned before, we're undergoing a change in how we establish regulations for migratory birds. I'd like to also provide you with information that we have available at this time to help drive our decisions next year, as well as any potential changes that we see for the 2016-17 season. As I mentioned, there is a new process that's starting, and these changes were implemented as a result of the Fish and Wildlife Service and how they wanted to operate into the future. In the past, we've come before you in March with adoption of the early season sometime in May and followed up with the late season typically being adopted in at the August meeting. That's all changing now. All migratory bird regulations will be rolled into a single regulation process starting with the 2016-17 season. This is going to allow Texas to establish both the resident and migratory regulations all at the same time and roll them into a single process. So what it's going to look like in the future, in November, we'll come to you with a briefing of what we perceive to be potential changes in the recommendations. In January, would present proposals for your consideration and then have those put into the state register with a final adoption by the commission in March. And after the final adoption, the Fish and Wildlife Service would publish a final rule sometime in May, which will allow us the opportunity to try to bring all of this information into a single document. With respect to information that we have available, no news is good news. We have nothing new. Basically, we're going to be moving forward with the 16-17 season using prior year's information. This is new for ducks. It's not new for Dove. We've used prior information in setting regulations for Dove, and we don't anticipate any real changes in the structure of the season. The frameworks will be basically unchanged. And just to kind of give you a highlight of what we see for waterfowl, which is ducks and geese, the framework for ducks, the outside dates would be the Saturday nearest September the 24th, closing date of the Sunday nearest January the 31st. For geese, the opening date, the earliest it could be, would be the 24th, just like ducks, but the framework allows you to run later, which is the Sunday nearest February 15th. We anticipate a liberal bag limit for ducks this year, which is essentially a 74-day season, six-bird bag limit, and we don't anticipate any changes for geese. For dove, the season frameworks and bag limits remain unchanged. We'll again be offered three zones with no more than two segments. The framework for the north and central zone will be September 1 through January the 25th. For the south zone, the earliest we can open next year would be September 23rd. The latest we could run would be January 25th. In the special white wing dove area, essentially same frameworks for the south zone, with the exception that we're provided four additional days in early September to take advantage of white wings. There is a big change coming. In the past, we've had a 70-day dove season. We were able to get that changed during this regulation process, and next year, Texas will be offered a 90-day dove season for the first time ever. We're basically going to be looking at ways to deal with that. For other migratory birds like snipe, rail, gallinule, woodcock, and cranes, we do not anticipate any changes with respect to the season structure or bag limits.
How many days do we have for dove now?
70.
Where do we stand, Carter? I don't know if it's for you or for you. You know, we were talking about trying to merge zones and everything at one point in time. Where is all of it? Are you fixing to address that?
I'm not, but I can.
Okay.
We do have we have the option, the opportunity, and it would be not necessarily for the 16-17, but for the 17-18 process. Trying to do some of the things that are necessary within a very shortened timeline, it would be smarter for us if we want to really address looking at the zones and splits.
Right.
It would be for the 17-18, with us taking forward a proposal to the Fish and Wildlife Service by May of next year. And then if we want to proceed down that path, we could implement it in the 17-18 season. And essentially what you're asking for is we do have the opportunity every 5 years to relook at zones and splits. But understand that right now Texas has a grandfather clause. And anytime you start tinkering with changing the number of zones, et cetera, we lose that grandfather ability and we can never go back. And what that grandfather ability is the January 25th closure. So if we were to recommend a change and go to two zones in the state, we could have three segments in the two zones, but we could not go to January the 25th. And whatever that southernmost zone currently the way it's structured, we could still not open any earlier than the Saturday nearest September 20th, but no earlier than the 17th. It's really wacky when you deal with some of these things. So we do have that opportunity. We are going to discuss it after we go through this process because we do not have to make a decision until next May. That gives us ample opportunity. We actually do have a survey out right now that's coming back asking questions about what the preferences would be of the dove hunters in Texas. But there are some things that we would have to seriously consider, particularly the 25th of January, which we would give up if we did go to change our zone split configuration as it currently stands.
So we would have to go back from the 25th and number of days?
Yes, sir. It would be January the 15th is the current closure. Yes, sir. So those are the things that we will have to certainly weigh before we would come forward, and we would certainly involve you in those discussions. But it is one of those grandfather clauses that Texas does have. We are the only state that does go to January 25th right now. So, Moving forward, with respect to the proposals are still being developed. We just got the final word from the Fish and Wildlife Service a couple of weeks ago at the Service Regulations Committee. And so we have yet to have an opportunity to sit down with the technical committee, much less have an opportunity to talk to a Migratory Game Bird Advisory Committee about any proposals. But from waterfowl, we don't see any changes in season length and back limit. We're going to have to look at calendar shifts simply because we need to understand the timing of the shifts, the splits. Are we going to maintain the splits at the same time, offset them? Because what we're looking at next year, we do have a leap year. And when you have a leap year, it really kind of throws things off by a few extra days. So those decisions have yet to be made yet, have yet to be even talked to. But we are going to look at the open and closing dates for the north and south zones. We don't necessarily anticipate much change with High Plains Mallard Management Unit simply because we do have the extra days. And as I said earlier, the bag limit, season length, waterfowl will be unchanged. For dove, this 90-day addition, these additional 20 days added on to the current 70, is going to require some discussion. And how is the best way to allocate those days by zone, as well as the best use of those days for the respective areas? So we're going to have some discussions with staff, as well as our advisory boards, to try to come up with what we think would be the best opportunity, considering when we open it, trying to ensure that the closing dates, it gets a little bit complicated because you want to try to close them all the same date. Certainly the second split, you would like to open the same date to avoid any confusion. So adding 20 days is certainly a blessing, but it does bring with it its own set of headaches as you try to structure season in a state as large as Texas. All other migratory birds will be very similar to last year. Those that typically coincide with waterfowl will continue to coincide with waterfowl. And most of them will have calendar adjustments where necessary. In summary, this whole new process is a learning experience for us all. All the states up and down the flyway and Fish and Wildlife Service, we're working towards that. The proposals are going to be developed by staff working in consultation with our Migratory Game Bird Technical Committee. Once we have proposals developed, we will then take those to the Migratory Game Bird Advisory Committee for their review and provide input, and we'll bring those proposals back in January. We do think that this new process is certainly going to be simpler for hunters with all the dates for deer, squirrel, rabbits, ducks, dove being adopted at the same time, because it will provide more lead time to plan for the next hunting season. With that, I'll answer any questions you may have.
Thank you, Dave. Questions for Dave? Appreciate it. Thank you.
Thanks.
Item 5, Aerial Wildlife Management. Kevin Davis, back up.
Thank you, Chairman. Commissioners, again, my name is Kevin Davis, for the record, and I'm with the Law Enforcement Division. Just wanted to give you guys an overview of a petition we received this past spring for rulemaking regarding aerial management of wildlife. To give you a little background, the petitioner and had a conflict with an aerial wildlife permit management holder. Basically, they had the same property. They had permission on the same property to conduct their activities. The petitioner had permission to hunt waterfowl, and the permit holder had permission to be conducting aerial management for hogs on the property. That created a conflict that neither party wanted the other one there. So we got involved in that and ran into a few issues, and the petitioner decided to look at our rulemaking process. Basically, he asserted that the current rules allowed for the harassment of migratory birds in violation of both state and federal law. He also asserted that adjacent landowners would actually stalk hogs next door to property where landowners were trying to eradicate hogs. He further suggested that we as a department should inspect properties to make sure that depredation is actually occurring by feral hogs prior to issuing a permit, and also wanted to look at a time frame where a season would occur for the management of feral hogs. He wanted that season to take place outside of other hunting seasons. Although the staff recommendation was to deny the permit, we did take his, to deny the petition. We did take his petition very seriously, and we were already looking at aerial permit changes needed. And so I'm going to articulate some of the reasons we denied, we suggested that we deny the petition. I want you to know that Mitch Lockwood's going to speak to some areas of his concerns that we were able to address in our proposal today. First of all, feral hogs are indisputably an ecological and agricultural menace. TPWD has a long history of trying to assist landowners in management of that specific species. TPWD did not wish to impose unnecessary restrictions on landowners in that endeavor. Unintentional disturbance of non-target species does not violate state or federal law. It's actually permitted under the Federal Airborne Hunting Act and state law. A season for management of wildlife and exotics from March 15th through August 31st would place a serious burden on landowners to actually manage their properties. And developing criteria for evaluation and inspection would place a burden on staff. However, I wanted to note that intentional harassment of other species under the guise of the permit is enforceable by law enforcement, and we can enforce that and do. With that, I'll take any questions.
I've got
Commissioner Morian.
I've got one. Just out of curiosity, if law enforcement observed an aerial hog eradication program that harassed ducks or anything else, unintentionally but incidental to the aerial hog hunting, what would law enforcement, what would be your reaction to that?
Well, we take all complaints seriously, and so we would talk to the parties involved and let the facts speak for themselves. But, you know, it's a highly regulated activity, meaning they have to keep daily flight logs, they have to turn those reports in, and the state legislature has deemed it pretty egregious to deviate or not do the practices that are required to be done under the permit. In fact, they make all violations that are not related to reporting a Class A misdemeanor. So we'll investigate that. We'll talk to all parties involved and actually go where the facts lead us.
But if you observe, I mean, it's not intentional. It's just incidental, and you're focused on the hog and you're not.
Incidental movement is not a violation of the law. So if they're operating under the parameters of the permit, there's not a lot we can do right there.
So you wouldn't respond?
Oh, we would respond every case and again, investigate and make sure that it was indeed incidental and not intentional.
Okay. Yeah. Interesting situation, but thank you.
Yes, sir.
Mitch? Good morning, Mr. Chairman, Commissioners. For the record, my name is Mitch Lockwood. I'm the Big Game Program Director. And this morning, I'm seeking permission to publish in the Texas Register proposed amendments to the rules governing the aerial wildlife management permit, which of course is the permit that authorizes the wildlife management activities from aircraft, whether it be conducting deer surveys or net gunning deer for triple T purposes, for example, or as Kevin just shared with you, shooting feral hogs from helicopters as well. Most of the amendments are intended to streamline and clarify our existing rules. For example, we propose to clarify that hunting license requirements apply to anyone who's attempting to take wildlife from aircraft, except those who are attempting to take depredating feral hogs or coyotes. We also propose to allow for the renewal of expired permits. And so our current rules require one to submit an application for renewal within 10 days prior to the expiration of their current permit. And that creates some administrative burdens both for the applicant and for our staff. And we simply propose to allow for the renewal of expired permits. Our current rules state that an LOA is valid for the duration of a permit, which could last for several years. And as Kevin Davis just shared with you, we have received at least one request for a permit to be specific, to be valid for a very specific period of time, and whether that be 3 days that's required to conduct the permitted activity, for example. And so staff have proposed to allow the LOA to be valid for the life of the permit or for time specified in the authorization. Now, I should clarify that the statute or the Parks and Wildlife Code does not give Parks and Wildlife Department the authority to make an LOA valid for a period of less than 12 months. In fact, the code specifically states that the LOA must be valid for at least 12 months. However, staff do believe that we have the authority and should respect the wishes of a landowner who would like to withdraw that authorization. Additionally, staff proposed to require a georeferenced map showing the exact boundaries of the property to accompany the LOA and for the landowner to verify the accuracy of the LOA in the map. And these requirements are intended to reduce the incidences of arrow wildlife management activities being conducted on the wrong property. Current rules allow for staff to approve LOAs in the field in emergency situations. It's not a common practice, and staff really believe that it's not necessary since LOAs are typically processed and approved within a day of the department receiving these. It does create some additional administrative burdens when they're approved in the field because it's not administrative staff who's doing this approval if it's in the field. It's a game warden doing it, and so a number's not assigned to this for tracking purposes. And so there's really no way to follow up on the activity that's being conducted on that property. We can't really follow up or track the reports associated with that activity for that property, which are required in order for us to comply with the federal reporting requirements. Therefore, staff proposed to repeal the rule that authorizes the LOA approval in the field. Several months ago, yes sir.
For what purpose would somebody need an emergency LOA? And this is assuming that they're not abusing the process, just what things would arise where you would need an emergency LOA?
Well, that is a good question. As few times as it has happened that I'm aware of in my career, it's been questionable. The instances that have come to mind have been questionable of whether or not it truly is an emergency. I would like to lean over to Kevin Davis to see if he has a good example.
Yeah, it's difficult to find an example of a real emergency related to an LOA. So
I couldn't think of one either. That's why I was bringing it up. I don't really see that we need that provision. But I didn't want to miss something in the event there was a hog showing up in your backyard. I don't think is an emergency. Might not be desirable, but I don't think it's an emergency.
How many have we issued?
So emergency LOAs, I'll have to get that number for you, sir. But I will tell you that the ones that I'm aware of all deal with an exotic, other than a hog, getting off a property and onto somebody else's. And whether or not that is an emergency has been what has been hard to determine. In most cases, the landowners are working together and resolving those issues in normal business hours, actually are able to resolve those.
Several months ago, the department began requiring that the quarterly reports be submitted electronically, and as you can imagine, that's greatly increased the efficiency for data entry and for reporting by our staff. And staff would simply like to clarify or propose that this rule be made clear that this requirement be made clear in the regulation. This proposal also includes permit denial language that's consistent with the permit denial rules that apply to various deer management permits. That is, that the department may refuse to issue new permits to or renew permits or revoke a permit for any person who has been finally convicted of, pleaded nolo contendere to, received deferred adjudication, or assessed administrative penalty for a violation of Parks and Wildlife Code, Chapter 43, Subchapters C, E, L, R, or R1, or a Parks and Wildlife Code violation that is a Class A or B misdemeanor, state jail felony, or felony, or a violation of Parks and Wildlife Code 63.002, or a violation of the Lacey Act. Staff also proposed that the department be able to refuse to issue a new permit or renew a permit or revoke a permit to any person that we believe and have evidence of that is acting as a surrogate or on behalf of someone who is prohibited from engaging in these permanent activities. And then finally, this proposal would prohibit someone from contracting as a gunner or an observer if that person has been finally convicted of, pleaded nolo contendere to, received deferred adjudication for, or assessed an administrative penalty for an offense that is listed in this section. And that concludes my presentation, but I'll be glad to answer any questions that you may have.
Kevin, Mitch, thank you. Any other questions?
The only question I had, I think, was probably for Ann. I noticed in some of the language, it looked like y'all were trying to clarify agent of the landowner or authorized agent for the landowner, or you were trying to take out that redundancy or whatever. You don't really need to comment one way or the other, but if you were trying to take out that redundancy, you might just want to run through. There are a couple of places where we still refer to an authorized agent. And I think probably where you're going with this is if you're an agent, you're already authorized. So that's the only comment I have.
Okay. Thank you.
Dan?
Yes.
One quick question. If we've established some review boards, so if a person, if we deny them a permit, what is their option to seek relief?
Well, that's a good question, and since this proposal actually does not address a permit review process like a lot of our DIP permits provide, I would ask if Ann Bright could come up here and address your question on what options there may be.
Good morning. I'm Ann Bright, General Counsel. Okay, there's sort of a practical answer and then the legal answer. And the practical answer is we could, if we wanted to, assemble a review panel to look at this. I will say we take, you know, these kinds of complaints very seriously. Somebody thinks that they were wrongfully denied. Legally, their legal option would basically be to sue us. You know, having said that, I guess, you know, we could always, if the commission wants us to, include something in the rules about a review panel.
We currently have a process for permittees for other permits, right?
Right, and what we would probably do is just reference that process.
Rather than a separate process?
I just question not having any recourse. I mean, to me, that I just been through this issue on a couple, you know. I mean, if they're bad, it would show up no matter what. I just question whether we need to address that issue.
Okay. I think it makes sense to keep it consistent with other review processes, so...
No, just that's easy enough. I mean, this wouldn't be up for adoption until January, and there are a number of other things that we're going to try to clean up in these rules, including some of the redundancy.
Good.
Observation.
Okay.
Good point.
Okay.
Thank you.
Okay.
Thank you. So I'll authorize staff to publish proposed rules regarding area wildlife management in the Texas Register for the required public comment period. Item number 6, chronic wasting disease update. Recommended adoption of interim proposed rules, briefing on potential carcass movement restriction rules, briefing on emergency trap transport and transplant, and TTP and DMP. Mr. Clayton Wolf.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, I'm Clayton Wolf, the director of the Wildlife Division. And as the chairman has already indicated, there's a quite a bit of material that I'm going to try to cover as quickly as possible related to CWD. Thank you very much for your patience in advance. One thing we feel like we need to do is really take a look at our timeline and some of our outreach. You know, this is these rules related to breeder permits and triple T permits and whatnot. The initial sets were interim emergency rules. And we were operating on a pretty compressed timeline. Nonetheless, we do want to share with you some of our outreach and how we were able to reach out to stakeholders to be able to get input and involvement that did actually influence the final text of the rules. And then also I'm going to talk about carcass transport rules. We were actually contemplating these even prior to the discovery of CWD in Medina County. What we anticipate is operating on the same schedule as the statewide hunting and fishing proclamation, but since this is CWD related, I'll include it as part of my presentation. Then I'll update you all on the emergency interim rules for Triple T, TTP, and DMP that were adopted on October the 5th. And then finally, I'll review again the interim deer breeder rules that we'll be asking you to consider for adoption tomorrow. And I do want to emphasize the term interim, particularly for the deer breeder rules, to let folks know. And at the end of my presentation, I'll talk about our process for the new set of rules that we will be bringing in early in January. First timeline of events, and I do want to recognize Dr. Andy Schwartz. He's the Assistant Executive Director, Texas Animal Health Commission, over here to my right. I think folks recognize the face from the special meeting. You know, with the discovery of CWD in Medina County and since early July, there have been numerous, sometimes even daily meetings with Texas Animal Health Commission primarily, but also to include USDA and the diagnostic lab in College Station, in working through the disease investigation, herd plans, rules. And in the early stages, early July, we met regularly and obviously relied quite a bit, not only on our own wildlife veterinarian, Bob Dittmar, but on the expertise of Texas Animal Health Commission professionals and the fact that they have some regulatory overlap, if you will, when it relates to CWD in these native species. So we've been working regularly. In fact, Friday had another working group meeting here with at our headquarters. But on July 8th, it was Mr. Smith and Executive Director D. Ellis of Texas Animal Health Commission that established a group of stakeholders. These were leaders within the deer hunting industry that we were using to outreach to, use as a sounding board, and also get input. And so our first stakeholder call was on July 8th. We also went to the TWA annual convention on the 10th. And briefed attendees at that convention about the discovery of CWD. And then had our first CWD task force meeting, and I want to make sure we don't confuse the working group with the task force. The task force is an interagency appointed advisory group, if you will. It's appointed by Mr. Carter Smith and Dr. Ellis, and these are primarily wildlife health professionals and producers in the cervid and deer breeding industry that we rely upon as we're talking about CWD rules. And so we briefed them on July 14th. Most of the discussion was about the index facility and what our plans were, and also receiving input on how to deal with that facility. Of course, we briefed this commission with a special meeting on July 16th. We had another stakeholder call on the 24th. And then we had an important meeting on August 6th with our CWD task force, particularly as it relates to these interim deer breeder rules that we're going to ask you to consider for adoption tomorrow. We spent many days working with Texas Animal Health Commission, USDA, to develop the first set of proposed rules. We rolled those out at that August 6th meeting here in the commission hearing room. And then in the following days, August 7th through 9th, there were numerous phone calls with leadership, primarily the leadership from Texas Deer Association and Deer Breeders Corporation, but also calls between Carter Smith and myself and my staff to see if we could make these take the input and make it workable and incorporate it into the rules. And as a result, there were some significant changes to those rules that were adopted as emergency rules. We took those proposed changes and had a conference call with the stakeholders again on August 10th. And because we needed to move forward quickly to be able to get deer breeders back moving again, because remember, there was on July 1, we basically had a moratorium on movement. Mr. Smith polled the organizations on the call and asked, he specifically said, "I'm not asking you to tell me if you like these rules." He says, "What we need to understand is, is this set of rules something that you can live with as a temporary set of rules for this hunting season until we can have more time to adopt a more more comprehensively study a new set of rules?" All the responses were affirmative at that call, and so with that response, we move forward. Now, to be fair to Texas Deer Association, we believe that perspective has changed some. We're anticipating a comment letter from them, or at the least, a comment tomorrow at the public hearing. And so just to be fair to them, I believe we may hear a change in perspective from Texas Deer Association. But at that point on August 10th, we proceeded with the knowledge that we had the head nod from everyone on that call. On August 14th, it was Dr. Ellis and I addressed the TDA annual convention, an update on where we were and with the rules and the epidemiological investigation. And then on the 18th, the rules were filed and effective. And, of course, we briefed this commission on the 19th and 20th. And an important point, on August 24th, the week after the commission meeting, TWIMS was activated. And this is an important point. Everyone, every deer breeder that was movement qualified prior to the moratorium by August 24th was back in business. Now, obviously, there might be some release site testing implications, but those that had met the movement qualification requirements prior to July 1 on August 24th, all those parties were back in business and eligible to move and liberate deer. And I've got to say, you know, just a Herculean effort by our wildlife permit staff and George Rios' staff and IT in doing all the development, the change in the coding, the testing. They were working on an extremely tough deadline, and they delivered, you know, a couple of days in advance, and so we were able to launch and actually launch flawlessly. So kudos to that group of staff out there that did all the development and testing within TWIMS. On September 1, we changed gears. We of course, had the adoption of the breeder rules, and so now we focused on another set of permits, Triple T, TTP, DMP, and we addressed our CWD task force meeting to receive input on some contemplated rules, took that input, then had another stakeholder call on the 16th, got some more input from the stakeholders and was able to incorporate that. And then on October 5th, by executive order, Carter Smith adopted these emergency interim rules for those particular permits, and I will cover that in a little more detail in a few minutes. I'm sure folks are probably a bit interested in where we stand with some of the testing. If you're this slide right here, obviously shows the general locations of the 30 facilities that provided deer to the index facility in Medina County. And the next slide here shows the 145 facilities in Texas that received deer from the index facility in Medina County, not including the two in Mexico. And this particular slide here kind of shows a breakdown. That's where we started, basically at the beginning of July. Our staff were able to pull the herd owner information, if you will, the facility owner information, provide that to Texas Animal Health Commission, and they did the heavy lifting on writing the hold order letters, developing herd plans in consultation with us, and getting with all these facility owners to let them know that they had a hold order, or to possibly learn some information that would free them of that hold order and also inform them of the requirements if they wanted to try to have that hold order released. And so this particular slide, this data was presented by Dr. Schwartz downtown at the Capitol on the 21st, a little update on these trace-in and trace-out herds. After folks got started, what we learned was that there were four of the facilities, the trace-in facilities, were actually closed by the time we discovered the CWD positive, so they were not in possession of any deer. There was no need to tell them to keep anything in place because they had closed their facility, vacated that facility of any deer, and so no hold orders placed on those facilities. But there were 26 active breeding facilities, and Animal Health Commission got with them, presented herd plans to all of them, and you'll see in the graphic there we have two herd plans. The word indicates herd plans. Those are herd plans that were signed and agreed to by the landowner. There are also two pending herd plans. Those are plans. A pending herd plan in this slide and others basically indicates they were presented a herd plan, at least at the time of this presentation, had yet to sign that herd plan. But I'm told by Animal Health Commission that after 15 days, that herd plan is effective. Now they can protest that herd plan, and there has been a small number of protests, but several herd plans that have presented that have not been signed. There's not been a protest. but essentially the herd plan is effective. The most important part is 22 of those facilities, the hold orders were released. So either through testing, where they tested out, or because of some temporal or spatial aspects that were learned during the investigation, Animal Health Commission deemed that that this was not a facility that would have provided a CWD positive deer to the index facility.
Miss, let me stop you. Go back to the pending herd plans, the two pending. That means they were presented with the plan, but they didn't sign it?
That's correct. That's correct.
So does that mean that we, I guess, let me rephrase the question. I take that to mean they may or may not be complying with the plan.
So maybe it might be a good idea to call Dr. Schwartz up. We're going to get into their business a lot more than my wheelhouse, and so if we could get him to come up here and explain how they handle pending herd plans, I think that would be best.
It's my suspicion the antenna has just went up.
Mr. Chairman, Commissioners, my name is Andy Schwartz, Assistant Executive Director with the Texas Animal Health Commission. And I'll attempt to address the pending herd plan situation. And Clayton explained it accurately that all of these individuals were presented with the herd plan, and the herd plan is in effect in 15 days unless they protest it. But we're trying to work through some details with some of these individuals, looking at, although it's beyond the 15 days, we're looking, researching in TWIMS and gathering other EPI information to see if there's anything that can be done to customize that herd plan for their situation. So we're trying to take into account each particular situation. So,
well, I guess my question is more general. If a person doesn't sign a herd plan, how do we know that they're doing the herd plan?
Well, that is a legitimate concern, and it's our concern as well. And so we met with Clayton Wolf and Mitch Lockwood and others here at Parks and Wildlife on Friday to discuss compliance issues, to use our both agencies' legal authority to ensure there's compliance. And so within the next 2 days, we're going through systematically with each of our regions and to discuss each particular situation so that we know which ones are not likely to be compliant. And the plan is to move forward together, the agencies together, to enforce those herd plans. And that's primarily, again, you know, not moving the animals, but also testing any animals that are harvested.
So I guess, and I don't mean to dwell on this because I know you got a lot of ground to cover today, but I guess what that means is if somebody doesn't sign the herd plan, to me that tells me what they're thinking, and so that means we have to step up our oversight, right?
I think that's a correct assessment. That's what we were looking for is obviously, I mean, we don't want to be too presumptuous in interpreting their motivation for not signing, but at the same time, I think it's probably prudent for us to understand the risk level associated with those facilities and to the extent to which we might have to exercise our authority if we have someone that's just, that is just not wanting to cooperate and there's some level of risk there that we feel like we need to address.
Distinction, maybe what you're asking, I think if this is correct, they would be under a hold order if they have an unsigned, unexecuted herd plan. Is that correct?
That's correct, but the hold order remains as long as they're under a herd plan as well. So they can only move by permission, basically.
Okay.
Okay. Maybe I'm overly sensitive, but I'm just suspicious of somebody who doesn't acknowledge the whole plan and acknowledge by signing that, yeah, I'm willing to commit to this. That raises a red flag to me that they may not be committing to it.
I would just say, Commissioner, I think both the leadership of both agencies share that concern, and so we're doing what we think is appropriate to address that. So.
Okay.
Okay, I'll continue on. I've got another slide on herd plans here, so Dr. Schwartz, maybe if we have any others, I'll ask him to stand by.
I'm sorry, just one more thing. Is that public record who they are? That I'm asking the question to, let's look at that over the next several days. I'd like to know if those two plans that have not been signed if that's a public record?
We can definitely get that.
Okay.
Get an answer for you.
Okay.
Because there's going to be some more in this slide as well, so it's not limited to two. And so when we talk about trace out herds, what we did was we discovered on the trace out herds that there were basically 14 closed facilities. Now there's a caveat. One of those was in our database as a closed release site. It's not a common occurrence, but someone can ask to basically have their release site deactivated and closed in TWIMS. So initially, there was no hold order, but I'll show where we did. Once we learned that it was a release site, then Animal Health Commission did issue a hold order for that site as well. But basically 133 herds with the current status in our system when we started or after we looked in deeper. 83 of those are breeding facilities, and essentially, close to three quarters of those, just shy of 75%, the hold orders have been released through testing. Or some epidemiological information, and then the remainder of those, and you can see we have 12 pending herd plans and 11 signed herd plans related to breeding facilities. As far as release sites, the data's inverted a bit, and that stands to reason because these are sites where deer have been released, and so folks don't necessarily have track of those animals or they could have been harvested in the past. So two-thirds of those release sites have herd plans. 20 of those are signed and 9 pending as of the date of this slide, and 16 release hold orders resulting from testing or the epidemiological investigation.
What would that, an example of that investigation be? If it's not testing, what's an example of something that would get a site released or a hold order released?
So if, for example, if they never received the deer, I mean, they showed it went, they transferred to them and threw them to another facility, if the deer was never received at that location, there wouldn't be a chance for exposure there. So
Direct delivery to the...
That's correct, yeah.
Okay. So right, and so the initial investigation is whatever data is in TWIMS, and so sometimes it may not necessarily be what we would intuitively think of as an accurate reflection of the transaction.
Okay.
The three DMP facilities, all those hold orders have been released. And then there's the two herds in Mexico that USDA is working with the federal authorities in Mexico. And then the one release site that was closed received a hold order as well. As far as the Medina County Index facility, you'll recall that there were 136 adult whitetail deer in the facility on July 1 and associated fawns. And in late July, we did some target sampling and authorized the facility owner to also collect some animals. And there's a natural mortality or two in there. And as a result of those 43 samples being sent to the lab, we came up with three additional positives. So that it totaled a number of four CW positives. Interestingly enough, all the positives are two-year-old males that were born on site. And then the final depopulation occurred on September the 30th. All those test results were in, and there were no additional positives. So obviously all those 2-year-old males were age and pen cohort. Some I would call distinct information, but it's not completely revealing yet because obviously, or I'll let you know. I mean, as far as we know now, we still have not been able to determine where or how CWD got into the facility, and what's unique about those animals and their relationship with each other or other potential animals that are now gone. And as you all know, one of those trace out facilities as a result of that purchased deer from the Medina County herd in October of 2014 had a natural mortality tested. That test was an age and pen cohort, so a 2-year-old buck as well, and it tested positive for CWD. So that facility was placed under quarantine by Texas Animal Health Commission. Approximately 156 adults and associated fawns in the facilities. This particular facility, and the investigation was not near as complex as the Medina County facility, number one, because they'd only been in business for a year. So our data showed that 84 deer had traced out to 9 facilities. You can see the breakdown of facilities there. Already, 5 of those hold orders have been released. So we basically have 4 standing hold orders still in place. I think it was the USDA had informed us last week that the count of animals in those other 4 facilities is 35 animals. So a lot less complex. And obviously we, you know, don't have any complexity on the trace inside because we know where the positive animal came from. A little bit about hunter harvest surveillance. You know, we focused a lot of time on permit programs because we need to get folks moving, and we had permits that needed to get issued. But we also had deer season coming up, and so staff that were simultaneously working on a new surveillance plan to really ramp up our sampling. Essentially, what that means is we're going to see over a 300% increase in our sampling goal as compared to our annual sampling goals in the past. Our previous goal statewide was 2,400 samples, and we're looking at around 8,000 samples this year is our sampling goal. And so it's all hands on deck, and staff has been doing a great job. Also, we refined our sampling strategy. We're stratifying by resource management unit instead of ecoregion. But even within those resource management units, we're doing a countywide risk assessment. So we'll be sampling in a county, but some counties may have just a minimum of 10 because their risk score was very low based on the parameters that we had. Other counties, we may be looking at well in excess of 100 samples per county to reach that total goal for the RMU. So it won't be equally distributed across, our sampling efforts will not be equally distributed across the landscape. And in addition, we're obviously going to target CWD positive areas and CWD exposed sites. We've hired 6 seasonals, or actually we have 5, and are extending a job offer here shortly to a 6th person to help us in this effort. And we've already distributed 2 news releases to let hunters know about our sampling efforts, so we can let hunters know how they can contribute to this sampling effort. If you go to our CWD website, we actually have an interactive map. And on that interactive map, there are push pins. And you can mouse over that push pin, and it'll tell you the times and dates when you can show up at a certain TPWD facility to have your deer tested. I do want to let you know, if you go look at that site, those are not the only sites where we're going to be checking deer. Those are the sites where we knew we could have staff there, say, you know, from 8 to 5 on Monday and Tuesday, et cetera. That's going to be primarily our WMAs and our district offices. But on opening weekend, this coming weekend, we're going to have a lot of staff at locker plants across the state, the places where people bring a lot of deer trying to get samples. But we also want to maintain some mobility when we do that, because if it's slow at one locker plant, we want to be able to pick up and move to some other place to get the samples. So the sites on the web, the push pins on the website represent those predictable sites, but we're going to be in many other places collecting samples. And so this slide right here, and I have to correct the date on there. I actually, Alan Kane provided data to me Monday, and so it was actually November 2nd data. We're now at 1,400 samples, so we're over 17% of the way there. This data is quickly accessible. We have an ARC collector. It's an application you can put on a tablet or your Toughpad or phone. Our staff is using that to collect their CWD data, and then they can sync that, and that data comes right in, and we can ask Alan to produce a report. In fact, we will be producing a weekly report. As a matter of fact, on October 29th, the number was 995. So we had, you know, since, you know, in that several day period, we'd gotten 400 samples from staff. And I think it's good news because general season has yet to open. We're going to get our biggest volume here in the coming weeks. And so I'm very proud of our staff and their efforts to reach out there and get samples, and all the hunters and landowners that are helping to contribute to this. We've had a lot of cooperation. We're very proud of that. And this just shows a map. This is a map that's produced. This is a screenshot of the map from that particular application. So not only do we get the numbers, but we can look at the distribution of sampling as it occurs, every week with our report. And, of course, West Texas, just FYI, mule deer, you know, MLD mule deer season opens this upcoming season as well. And so some of those places in South Texas where hunting is, you know, a little slow until it cools off, we're certain we'll be able to fill those voids. Switching gears to carcass transportation rules. We share information with our staff. You can go to our website and you can see this common sense precaution for handling and processing deer. You know, we do want to reiterate that all the science out there, all the trials that have been done to look at the transmissibility of CWD humans indicates that it cannot occur. And so we want to emphasize that point. Nonetheless, you know, if we have a deer that has CWD, you know, it's advisable not to consume animals with disease, or someone just makes that choice. And so we do let folks know the organs in the parts of a deer where the prions tend to accumulate. This particular diagram shows the organs and the lymph nodes, spine, brain, etc. And there has been plenty of research to show that you can have site contamination by the distribution of a contaminated carcass. And so what we want to do we're considering for next hunting season is some rules that are similar to other states that would prohibit the movement of spinal tissue and the brain from CWD positive states and CWD positive areas in Texas. This particular map here basically shows the states or the portions of states that have CWD throughout the U.S. and Canada. And then, of course, we have the containment zone and the high-risk zone in West Texas. And so we'll be working with law enforcement to refine a proposed rule to make sure that it's workable, it reduces the risk of spreading the disease, yet it's not onerous. You know, obviously we need to consider individuals that want to have an animal mounted, you know, and taken to a taxidermist, and we don't want these rules to be onerous, but we do want something that's prudent for minimizing the spread of CWD across the landscape via an infected carcass. Along the similar lines, yes, Vice Chairman.
Before you move on, going back to the common sense precautions, that page. I'm curious why we say do not shoot a deer that appears sick.
Well, that goes along with if they're going to shoot it just for recreational harvest and consumption. Now, what we do ask folks to do is if they see a deer, to contact us if it's a sickly deer, and we can authorize them to take that animal for sampling purposes. And there also is a statute that allows for the dispatch of an injured or an obviously diseased animal. So it's not illegal for someone to do that. If someone does do that, we urge them to contact us quickly to get that carcass so we can get a sample pulled. But the precaution is generally for a hunter that it has the intent of consuming a carcass.
Well, it seems like we might want to clarify that today.
Good point. Point taken.
When a hunter, any consideration of disposition of you know, other parts of the deer that aren't consumable? I mean, how they dispose of it and what they do with it?
There
might involve a lot of these other things like lymph nodes and spleen and so forth. So
with the normal, obviously the spleen and such usually is left in place at the site for field dressing. But, you know, a couple of those lymph nodes are, you know, embedded in the hindquarters, and you're not going to get to them till you debone your meat and take it apart. And that would be, you know, remnants of scraps that would, I guess, you know, if you're doing your own, would go in the garbage. We do recommend to folks, when you're talking about the rest of the head, the eyes, the advice is not to just throw a bunch of animal parts into your trash can unless you have talked with the person that's taking care of picking up your waste there, because some landfills are approved. The type 1 landfills are approved for that kind of material. I don't know if Dr. Schwartz, if you got anything to add related to advice that we give folks related to those.
Not at this point. No.
And then FYI, so the depops that we did, you know, if we have a site that is CWD positive, you know, there are a lot of precautions we take to make sure that, I mean, everyone wears the full suits, and essentially when we take depop those animals, we make sure that there's not any bodily fluids or anything that escapes that lion trailer, and that goes to a type 1 landfill. So we're very careful about our handling of carcasses from these CWD positive sites. If someone shoots a deer before they get to their final destination, they're required to maintain proof of sex of that animal. It's for bag limit enforcement purposes. And so for a buck, that's the head with the antlers attached. For an antlerless deer, that's the head. But you can also have a receipt from a taxidermist, a statement from a landowner. You can get a PWD 905. That's our CWD collection form from our staff, or any of the permits serve for that purpose as well. But because we're encouraging folks to provide us samples, we realize there may be some places out there, some ranches, where someone wants to leave some heads behind in a cooler for us. The landowner's not present. They're not on MLD. We can't provide them a receipt, yet we don't want to have, but yet we want them to be able to leave legally with the carcass. And so what we're investigating is looking at an additional form of proof of sex documentation, much like other states have. If you go to Colorado or Virginia, that would allow for the visible sex organs to be also proof of sex of the animal that you harvested. So we'll also be working with law enforcement to further refine that language to make sure that it's something that is enforceable, something that allows for latitude, but it also is something that's workable for our deer hunters. So on to Triple T, TTP, and the TTP permits. The previous rules prior to the adoption of these emergency interim rules for Triple T basically allowed someone to trap free-ranging deer from one site, move those deer to another site, but in order to do that in advance of being permitted, they had to provide to us not detected CWD results on 10% of the animals that they were permitted to move, no fewer than 10, no more than 40. In the later years, we actually add an incentive to these rules to incentivize folks to get to to 60 samples, and when they got to that point, then their annual testing requirement was reduced to 3% or a minimum of one deer. We also allowed folks to use samples from the previous season. We visited with our CWD task force on these rules, and we're all in agreement that really, in light of the current circumstances, we want to get current testing. And so the recommendation that staff presented and that we got input on from the task force, and ultimately the emergency rules that were adopted by Mr. Smith, they eliminate the what we call the preferred status for 60 samples. They eliminate the provision that allows you to use samples from a previous season. We also have a provision that does not allow for triple teeing from Class 3 release sites. And as a result of input from our stakeholders, these testing provisions now also apply to TTP. TTP does not have the same risk because we're not moving live animals, but nonetheless, it's an opportunity to get sampling off of other populations out there, and so... So this testing requirement also in the emergency interim rules applies to TTP permittees as well. Deer management permit, as many of you may know, is a permit that allows for the trapping of animals on a high fence ranch, the temporary detention in a breeding facility, no more than one buck and 20 does. And as that regulation developed through the years, we allowed for the introduction of breeder deer into these facilities, and breeder bucks may return to their originating facilities, but does must be released. And so essentially, we have a nexus with that deer breeding network, or at least a potential nexus, and there is a release. And so it goes to reason that these are essentially the same as deer breeder releases. And so the staff recommendation and ultimately the rule, the emergency interim rule for DMP treats DMP release sites just like deer breeder release sites. If you receive a deer from a TC2 facility, then that ultimately will become a Class 2 release site. When breeder bucks are transferred to a DMP facility, sometimes they go back. And sometimes they go back to a different facility. And so following the same logic, if if you have a TC3 buck and it goes to a TC2 facility, that facility status is downgraded. And then also the emergency interim rules require that all breeder deer placed in a DMP facility that is a Class 3 release site must have an official form of ear identification. And so the Triple T, these rules, the Triple T rules, TTP rules, and DMP rules were all filed and effective October 5th, 2015. If you include the 60 days extension, then essentially the period of validity for these rules will be able to cover the entire Triple T and TTB season. So we see no reason to come back for a formal adoption of these rules. We'll basically look at these in January as we consider the deer breeder rules and all the other rules. But the emergency period covers the whole effective date for Triple T's and TTPs. So we see no reason to seek permission to publish those rules for public notice and comment. However, the MLD season and the detention of those deer can run up into next fiscal year. And so we are seeking permission to publish the interim DMP rules for public notice and comment just to make sure we don't have a void between the expiration of the emergency interim rules and when we develop our new rules in the upcoming year. Yes, sir.
I don't know if this is for you, Carter. I don't know if anybody else has been getting them, but it seemed like I started getting them about Tuesday last week. Some phone calls from people that, and it surprised me, some of the people that called me, that had heard that we were adopting the rules to make permanent what we've done on the emergency orders, which we all know is not accurate, but I just bring that up because perhaps while you're putting this information out, apparently some people have not got the message that this is a strictly this hunting season kind of deal. We all know what we intended to do, but
good point taken. We have heard that input as well. In fact, I've got a slide at the end that we're hoping we can convey to everyone that and it's been said on the record many times by Carter Smith that this is for one season only. We are committed to revisiting these rules.
We will, Commissioner. I don't know how to say it more clearly, but we will say it once again that these are interim, these are transitional, these are emergency. We plan to come back with proposed revisions in March to the Commission with a proposal for you to consider adoption in May. I think what that will do is we'll give everybody a very clear sense of what the playbook is, the rules of the road, a blueprint for going forward, and I think that's important for planning, business certainty, et cetera. So we are absolutely committed to working through coming back with the next suite of recommendations based on a lot of input from all of the myriad stakeholders, and there are a lot of stakeholders, as you know, in this dialogue to come back with revisions, through the normal regulatory process. So that'll be very clear. It'll be open. It'll be participatory. And people will have very ample notice as to what's going on, what's being proposed, and what ultimately is adopted, and have ultimate clarity on that. So we'll continue to reinforce that as explicitly as we can, Commissioner. And I'm glad you raised it because Clayton is right. That criticism has reached a crescendo in recent weeks. And again, I'm not sure how to say it any more clearly than what we just did.
Yeah, it may just be because regular season is opening Saturday. It could
right.
just be.
Could be.
Kind of just.
Yeah. Good point.
Thank you, Commissioner. So now we're here we're on the home stretch as far as my presentation goes, what I'm going to do now is cover these interim proposed rules for breeder deer movement and liberation, emphasizing interim. And obviously the vast majority of these rules are identical to the emergency rules that were filed, but obviously they will expire, and we want to make sure that we don't leave a gap out there of unregulated an unregulated time period. You can rest assured I'm not going to go through this flow chart again like I did last time. I think I sufficiently impressed everyone last time I navigated it. And but it is important I think to just demonstrate that as we sat down, we tried to develop some tools that for folks that are in the deer breeding business, it means something. And to try to get them, help them navigate these and understand where they sat as well, particularly in the early phases We distributed this information just within days after the rules were, or the day the rules were adopted. But more simply put, previous to the adoption of the emergency rules, you basically had two movement statuses. You were movement qualified or you weren't movement qualified. The new rules now have three levels of movement qualification in addition to being not movement qualified, and that's transfer category one, transfer category two and three, and then the associated release sites. And so I think you've heard me say this before, but essentially if you're a release site or if you want to receive breeder deer and you receive breeder deer from one of these transfer category one sites, then that creates, that basically makes your ranch a class one release site. If you also want to get deer from a TC2 facility, then the lower classification will prevail, and you will be bound by the Class 2 release site provisions, and the same for TC3. I've also referred to this model of testing requirements as a compensatory testing model, and if you look at the slide here on the left side of the screen is the testing performance, kind of a relative scale of testing performance for breeding facilities, and so a TC1 falls at the top end of that scale, and so if you're at the high end of testing performance, then the associated release site is at the low end of the testing requirements. In this particular case, there are no additional testing requirements for Class 1 release sites. If you're at the mid-level of testing in the breeding facilities, then there's moderate testing requirements at the release site. And if you're at the low end of testing performance in the breeding facilities, then the testing requirements are at the highest end of the spectrum at the release sites. And so what does that look like? I'll quickly review these. I know we saw these in August, but the Transfer 1 categories are these certified and these fifth-year herds. These are herds that are rolled with Texas Animal Health Commission. There's annual monitoring, and they're expected to test 100% of their eligible mortalities. They also must have a reconciled herd of inventory, and they cannot be one of these exposed sites, one of these Tier 1 sites. And these, any facility that receives deer from a Class 1 or from a TC1 facility is a Class 1 release site, and there are no additional testing requirements because of the testing performance in those breeding facilities. Transfer Category 2 is really, it's kind of the new standard we developed, and that requires that if you want to be at TC2, you test 4.5% of the average population of the facility over the last 2 years. And you also must have a reconciled herd inventory and not be a Tier 1 site. You may voluntarily sacrifice animals to meet the 4.5% standard. And when I present to you some of the public comment, we did receive a few comments about, implying or maybe even outright stating that the rules required someone to sacrifice deer. And in fact, that's not the case. These rules... if someone is at TC3, if they want to go to TC2, they may have to sacrifice animals to get there, but they can also operate at that TC3 level without sacrificing deer. And these Class 2 release sites must test a minimum of 50% of the hunter-harvested deer or a number equivalent to 50% of the deer release, whichever is less. And these were these couple of components here were, we made some significant changes as a result of stakeholder input there in August 7th through 9th. Irrespective of the first two bullets, they must test 50% of the breeder deer that are liberated and harvested in the same season. And in transfer category 3, is basically it's our old movement qualification standard. They must have tested 20% of their eligible mortalities since May 23rd of 2006. And obviously have a reconciled herd inventory. And then those exposed sites, those Tier 1 sites, can also be in this TC3 category as well. The testing standards on Class 3 release sites are the highest. They're required to test 100% of the hunter-harvested deer or a number equivalent to the number of deer released, whichever is greater, breeder deer released. And then they must also, all deer released on these sites must have that the official forms of identification, specifically the RFID tag or the National Uniform Ear Tagging System clip tag. Just a few other general provisions. A deer breeding facility will assume the status of the originating facility from it with which it received deer if that facility is of a lower status. These release sites have to be high fenced. And the Class 2 and 3 release sites have to maintain a daily harvest log on site. So those were all components that were presented to you, to each of you at the August Commission meeting. And then since that time, we've received questions from folks if we, you know, the what ifs. And so we were looking at everyone that was a deer breeder at that time and trying to put them in the particular categories based on testing performance. But then someone asked the question, well, what about a new deer breeder? You don't have any testing performance. So where do we fall? And so the rules that we're asking you to adopt tomorrow also include a provision that, that simply states that a new deer breeding facility will inherit the lowest status level from among all facilities from which it received deer. Seems to make sense. If a facility is downgraded because it received deer, say if you're TC2 and you receive a TC3, the question was asked, how long do I stay at TC3? Because they're really testing at a higher performance level. And the rule we're asking you to adopt would basically state that they must stay at that point for 2 years. To some degree, that's kind of a moot point because we're going to be looking at these rules in January. So we don't know if that'll be the same, but nonetheless, it provides some closure to that question, at least temporarily. In the new facilities, the same question asked. If I'm a new facility, when do you calculate my status? And the rules we're asking you to adopt would have that status calculated after a period of 2 years And then finally, Commissioner Scott, to your question, you know, we have been receiving a lot of questions about the temporary nature of these rules, and we had a suggestion that these rules have an expiration date. And so the rules we're asking you to adopt would indicate that the interim rules will expire August 31st, 2016. But as a point of departure, we're certain that we're going to have a new set of rules well in advance of that. I'll just briefly talk about our winter schedule. Dr. Schwartz has been working with Dr. Dittmar on our staff and other members of our staff, and we are planning for a symposium in January. To really look at the newest science, you know, to address these questions like what are the population level impacts, you know, what's the real story on live animal testing as far as sensitivity, looking at, you know, at the statistical reliability so we can assign some kind of risk level. And so we'll be doing that in January. And then from January through March will be rule development, looking, you know, working with our stakeholders, our working groups, our task forces, et cetera, to develop and refine rules that we will come to, that we plan to come to this commission in March, seeking permission to publish rules. So folks will already have a pretty good idea of what we're looking at, even if they're not actively engaged in that process. And then ultimately look to seek adoption of rules in May. And so that's our schedule that we are shooting for. We're going to hit the ground running right after the new year, and staff has already been developing a list of experts and speakers to get down here so we can get that CWD symposium off the ground in early January and get things rolling. As far as public comment, this is a little different than what you have on your computer. Updated early this morning, the public comment is now at on these particular rules is 569 that agree with the rules and 355 that disagree. In addition, we've received some letters from organizations, and we'd like to, you know, highlight those organizational comments. We received one letter that has 26 signatories on it, and the sum and substance is that they encourage the TPWD Commission to adopt the rule in its entirety. And so this slide shows some of those signatories as well. This slide, and I'll give you a second to look. The next. And then finally, the last slide. Additionally, received one, an individual letter from East Texas Woods and Waters Foundation, essentially encouraging TPWD to adopt the rule in its entirety as well. And actually during this meeting, just by hour and a half ago, we also received an email from Ducks Unlimited with a letter addressed to the chairman. And the email essentially says they support the CWD rules. And then you'll notice I put support down there for Texas Farm Bureau. We received a letter from Texas Farm Bureau, I think, that all of you may have seen, that shares their policy positions that relate to these CWD rules, but they don't necessarily get into the specifics of saying we agree with the rules or disagree with the rules, and so we didn't want to misrepresent their letter. But I will read the second to last paragraph. Farm Bureau policy favors Texas Parks and Wildlife Department and the Texas Animal Health Commission addressing disease problems associated with interstate and intrastate shipment of native wildlife, particularly those related to the hunting economy of Texas. Additionally, Farm Bureau policy supports continued research to develop a live test for CWD, which will obviously be part of the subject matter in our January meeting. And then, as we typically do, we try to characterize the comments on all the disagreement the best we can, and at least hit on the more common themes. And so the most common theme we got was there's identical or nearly identical comments that were submitted opposing the rule. Essentially, it's a rather long email, but the salient points were that there's not an emergency, no considerable threat, current testing requirements are injuring the industry without cause, and specifically the specific request of the commission related to this disagreement is to, in addition to considering all the rules, is to specifically dispense with the Class 2 release site testing. And so that was the most common reason for disagreement. The 86 count does not include those our analysis of what came in overnight, so that I probably will update that by tomorrow. And then other common themes, there were 9 comments that essentially opposed deer breeding or the rules are not stringent enough. There's a feeling of overreach or overreaction by the department. There are 9 that are in opposition because they believe that the rules require deer to be sacrificed, that the rules are punitive, and singling out deer breeders. We had 10 comments in that category. We had 8 comments that the rules should allow for live animal testing. That testing should be the same for all deer, 5 comments. And then we had 4 additional comments that opposed release site testing, and that there are 3 comments that the disease is contained, that there's no emergency. And then just some other general comments and themes that I could pick up from reading through the summary was that that there would be negative economic impacts on deer breeders, land value, and local economies. And that concludes my presentation. I'll be happy to answer any questions.
Clayton, thank you. That was very good. Commissioner Scott.
I follow all the stuff you were doing on the breeders and then the release sites and everything. My question is, I don't see anywhere on here where we're addressing a situation if a facility is a deer breeding facility, high-fenced, and they only release on their particular land, and they don't sell, they don't bring any in, they don't have any outside contact. Where do they fall in all this?
So they would also be a Class 1, 2, or 3 release site. So irrespective of whether you ship your deer 100 miles to a ranch or you liberate them from your facility onto your own ranch on your own site, the rules see no difference in that. It would be treated as a release site.
I don't know if I may have a further question on that. I'm not sure that I follow. If you've never brought any in, I'm having a little problem on trying to follow the logic. I understand it clearly on if anybody has bought some, if they've moved them or sold them. I understand that one. But if it's a 100% contained situation, why would they fall into the same category as people that deer breed and sell them, move them, do the hunts and all that?
Oh, ma'am. So, ma'am, I don't understand the question. Are you referring to a deer breeder?
I'm referring to an all-inclusive deer breeder. In other
okay.
words, they breed them on site, they release them on their site, and nothing ever moves outside of that high fence, and nothing is ever brought in to that high fence.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so your question, Commissioner, is, you know, what's the epidemiological assessment on that? And, you know, is it there some
acknowledgement? Assume that they're doing a lot of testing.
And assume that they're doing a lot of testing. So, you know, maybe that's up Clayton or Andy, if you want to address that. I mean, obviously there are those situations out there where you have facility owners that have a breeder facility and then they immediately release deer onto their own ranch, which is, again, a permitted release site. I know that was considered, obviously, as part of the emergency rules and is categorized as such. Are you suggesting that's something that we need to look at going forward in terms of how we categorize that?
I think it appears to me, and maybe I'm not understanding it, but it appears that for somebody that has no exposure for getting it, for transporting it, for moving it, it just seems to be like they're being penalized for something that they're not even doing.
Yeah.
It's a good comment, and part of the discussions of our working group, the level of exposure really was a part of our active dialogue when we started looking at, from everything from certified herds, fifth-year herds, three-year herds, because, you know, what you describe in the classic sense is a certified herd that's been monitored. There's no new introductions. They're doing a high level of testing, and then once you get to that fifth year, your risk of having CWD is much reduced. And then everything really is on a scale coming off of there, just depending on it, on your exposure to deer breeding facilities. Now, obviously, when they started, you know, they received deer from somewhere. And so that was all part of the active dialogue as we tried to figure out how to develop these classifications and where we draw the line in those, and where we settled. But no doubt, you know, you could slice the pie, you know, in a few more slices and have different categories. And we tried to make it not too complex, but it will be part of the discussion as we move forward.
Clayton,
you know,
how would we currently categorize that example? Would it be, it's not a TC by definition?
No, so that...
Would it be a DMP?
Or how would you... Well, it's my understanding that Commissioner Scott is talking about a deer breeding facility, but they're one that's really been disconnected from the industry for a long time. One of the things, in the caveat that you gave us of testing, because when we talk about that, we do have herds that are disconnected, but they don't necessarily have good testing performance. And that caused us some concern. And then, of course, the other thing we had to consider is, as we find new CWD positives related to this, we didn't want to have a model, or we were trying to avoid a model where there would have to be an intensive assessment every time we had a new positive, so that we'd have to shut down the industry for an extended period of time. And so that, you know, going 2, 3, 4 generations out was also something we considered, But it'll obviously, all of those, you know, working with Animal Health Commission, all those factors that contribute to risk or those things that mitigate risk, as you indicated, are will be part of our consideration as we move forward.
That example would almost be like a DMP, right? Because it's contained in the release site, is there.
It is, but obviously a DMP can have a nexus with a deer breeding facility.
Right.
And so it depends, but you're right. If it's a DMP that does not utilize breeder deer, then there's in the movement. Obviously, in the movement and the connectivity to this network are all part of that risk assessment. And there's no black and white line. It's simply a gradation as you move through it. But a DMP not without deer breeding would be closer to that kind of example.
Commissioner Martin,
I've got a question. There's no test on this, is there?
No, sir. I'm not sure I would score very well.
But in this case, I'm just trying to get in this case, the penalty that you're talking about, is that the additional testing or the testing they would have to do?
So that's the way.
There's no other requirements.
That's correct. Keeping that harvest log, and of course that's what has created the most consternation, at least among those that disagree with the proposal, is the release site testing. That it is a new. It's a new aspect. It's something that has been talked a lot with, you know, among folks, you know, in the industry. It's been talked a lot about here, but we've never entered into that. And so when we were contemplating the rules, what we were trying to figure out is How do we get everybody back moving again, yet mitigate disease risk? And so we really the best model that we could come up with, since folks had already had their testing performance, and we were going to launch off of that, was to transfer some of that testing burden to the release site so that everyone could continue to move. But obviously, so it's new to the model. I have to tell you also, when you're looking at trying to look at natural mortality in a captive deer breeding pen, natural mortality is pretty low, 4.5% on an annual basis. And so the statisticians, when they look at that, it takes a long time to get enough mortalities if you're just restricting yourself to the deer breeding pens. But obviously, if you have a hunting operation that's associated with that, and there's a lot of deer that are being harvested, it's a great way to capitalize without requiring anybody to sacrifice any more deer. The animals are already being harvested, and so it's just at a different location. So, but to your point,
I'm just following up on Commissioner Scott's question. I'm not sure I understand what the self-contained breeding operation requirement would be, other than testing. Am I missing something?
No, you're not. I mean, I think to be fair, and Commissioner Scott said it well. People that are subjected to enhanced testing requirements, some perceive that as being punitive. That is absolutely not the intent. From an epidemiological perspective, the goal is to get more samples, and that was made abundantly clear.
But you could just revert back to the 20%. Is that right?
You could, in
the example, for instance, that Commissioner Scott articulates, if someone is testing at that 20% level, they're self-contained, they've been removed, they can still release deer onto their own ranch, but they are going to have to test 100% of those hunter harvested deer on that ranch, since 100%.
Okay.
In that lowest TC3 category.
Thank you.
Commissioner, I think just to close the loop on what you asked about, you know, you're raising a question about connectivity and how we address that going forward and risk assessment. Obviously, as we go forward, looking at these interim transitional emergency rules that we propose to put in place through this hunting season and then revisit in March, those kind of situations that are more site-specific, you know, we do have and will have more of the luxury of time to be able to assess those and do a better risk assessment on.
That was going to be my suggestion, is that we do look closely at, or have a option to grant specific things if it so warrants.
Yeah, you're right, and I think that's the great caveat on there. You know, what do the epidemiologists say in terms of the level of risk, and how do we accommodate that within a proposed realignment of this disease containment model? Absolutely.
That's good.
Questions for Clayton? Dr. Schwartz? Thank you.
Thank you
both very much. Appreciate it.
Thanks.
So I'll place the adoption of interim proposed rules on the Thursday Commission meeting agenda for public comment and action. We'll also authorize staff to publish proposed interim rules regarding DMP in the Texas Register for the required public comment period. Work session item number 7 is State Park Rules, request permission to publish proposed rule revisions in the Texas Register. Mr. Kevin Good.
Morning, Commissioners. My name is Kevin Good. I'm with the State Parks Division. And today we're requesting permission to published proposed amendments to the Texas Administrative Code, Chapter 59, which deals with the state park system. Now, some time ago, State Park was asked to do a comprehensive review of Chapter 59, which governs the system. Currently, there are 10 subchapters in this chapter, and its programs have not been reviewed in a number of years, as you'll see. So we've been working closely with Ann and her staff to
go through these rules and have identified some changes that and improvements that we feel could be made. After we went through this review, there were six subchapters, the ones highlighted in yellow, that were found to be in need of some revisions. These range from minor amendments and additions to complete rewrites of some sections. So in undertaking this review, staff was guided by several principles. First and foremost, we wanted to simplify the language that was in the rules to provide clarity for staff and our public as well. We wanted to remove obsolete language. There were several sites that are referenced that are no longer in operation as part of the park system. We recognized that there was a changing environment in parks, and these proposals would provide greater flexibility for staff to consider revenue-generating opportunities or address customer needs. We also felt that there was a need to address some issues that have arisen in parks in recent years, such as concerns over exotic or invasive species and some operational issues that have come to our attention. And finally, although you'll see some major changes in regards to the fee system, we really did not want to use this as an opportunity to change park fees. We felt like that was sort of a separate issue that needed to be addressed on its own. Starting out with subchapter A, as currently written, it's really one of the most confusing pieces of the code that we've run across. So we are proposing that this entire section or subchapter be repealed and replaced with new language. In order to make these more understandable, we took several steps. First, in reference to the entrance fees and park passes, all of those are currently scattered up and down the 24 separate clauses in this subchapter. So we took those and grouped them together into several standalone sections. We eliminated the obsolete fees, such as the references to train fares that we have not operated since 2007, state fishing piers, which have been gone even longer than that, the Matagorda Island Ferry, those kinds of things. We took all of those out. We also are proposing to reduce the number of facility categories. Right now, we've got six types of facilities listed. Those rules are for recreation halls, group lodges, dining halls, pavilions, amphitheaters, gymnasiums, and bunkhouses. And then in addition to that, to make it even more confusing, colloquially, on a site-specific basis, those facilities may have a different term that people refer to them as. For instance, the dining hall at Bastrop State Park is usually referred to as the refectory. Frankly, it's hard to understand which fee would apply to those. So we really just took those and grouped them into two new categories, group day-use facilities and group overnight-use facilities. We also want to establish authority to combine entrance fees, facility fees, and activity fees into a single package fee in some circumstances. Particularly at a site like Big Bend Ranch, it might make more sense to have a little bit more user-friendly pricing structure so that we may be able to combine entrance fees, the facility fee, and perhaps a tour or an activity fee all into a single package that we could give the customers just a single price for their visit. We feel like that would be a little more user-friendly again, and then also particularly more attractive to perhaps some group use. And then similarly, a new single fee is established to replace five current fees that are on the books. Right now we have authority to have a filming fees, special public activity fee or wedding fee, special event fee, park operations fee, and a commercial use fee. Again, just really confusing to park users, and we have tried to take all of those and put them into one fee that staff could implement by looking at what the cost of a special event might be, where it incurs perhaps additional staff time, utility cost, There may be some times when it impacts other visitors that might then decide not to come to a park, and we would lose that revenue. So we want to take all of those factors, look at them, and put them into a single package that then would be put into a contract with those event promoters. We also have three types of annual passes that are on the books right now. Those stay on the books, but again, it was really confusing the way it was organized, and so we just went through and grouped all of these together and have tried to make that a little bit more easy to understand. First is the annual park entrance pass, typically referred to as the state park pass. We just took all the rules regarding the benefits the holder of that pass gets, where it applies and what the fee is, put that into one section, did the same for the youth group annual entrance pass. And then finally, the Parklands Passport, which is usually referred to as the Blue Bonnet Pass. This pass is actually established in legislation, and so we referred back to that legislation and then just put those eligibility and proof of eligibility requirements into the code. So it's very clear, we hope, that a user that may wish to pursue one of these passes can show up at a park, show them their driver's license, and say, I'm over 65, I want my Blue Bonnet pass. Subchapter C currently provides guidance and authority for staff to ensure the conservation of cultural resources in state parks. But there wasn't a corresponding section that related to natural resources, and instead we had one long section that governs historic sites. So the idea was that we took all of these and reviewed them, reworked them to provide guidance for all of our state parks in the system, rather than just focusing on those historic sites. And because of changes to our park inventory over the past 20 years or so, with moving a number of sites out of our system, we wanted to eliminate some sections that were no longer really applicable. So in that, we took the acquisition criteria for parklands that is currently in subchapter C and K, combined it all into this one section, and made it apply to all of our sites. We did the same with the development guidelines. And then we deleted the four sections that really provided a lot of detailed information specifically regarding historic sites. Those were the thematic organization. There were more categories of themes listed than I think we have historic sites at this point. Additional funding guidance, maintenance guidance, and personnel guidance selections. All of those were just overly detailed, we thought, and really not necessary at this point in time. So those were removed. In subchapter E, which regards park concessions, we made much fewer changes, and so this just amends the current language. We really had two goals in this area: to eliminate the unnecessary language and provide greater flexibility to staff to pursue revenue-generating opportunities and operate in a more business-like manner. Right now, there are 10 types of concessions that are listed in the administrative code. I won't go through all 10 of those, but suffice it to say that between those 10 types of concessions that are listed, it pretty much covers any type of business that could possibly be done in a park. So rather than having all of that specific language in there, we've just authorized the parks to have concessions. We also simplified the contract terms and language that is in the code right now. Again, these contracts are all governed by other state law, and so the specific and detailed language that's in the code just seemed a little redundant and often hard to understand, so we just have proposed to simplify that. And then I should also note that all of our
contracts are reviewed by legal staff to ensure that the interests of the department are protected. And we wanted to provide flexibility to staff to look at new business opportunities that might be out there or be proposed and take opportunities to utilize those when it makes sense. The next section is the park operational rules. These are sort of the visitor behavior rules. First of all, we wanted to establish that we have clear authority to close parks when necessary. Over the past years, in fact, past weeks, we've seen that parks obviously are impacted by natural disasters and other events. And as we went through this review, there didn't seem to be any place where it clearly stated that during an emergency, we can close a park to visitors. It was implied, but it just wasn't really clearly stated. So we thought it would be useful to have that in there. There may also be times such as doing a prescribed fire where we may want to close a park. Again, we just want to make sure that it's clearly understood that we have that authority. Another more minor issue is expanding the types of animals that are allowed on park trails. Over the years, we've had a number of requests from owners of llamas that they be allowed to utilize those as pack animals on park trails. We've looked at that. There do not seem to be any issues regarding transmittal of diseases between species and other species and llamas. So there just didn't really seem to be a good reason to prohibit that use. And so we've just proposed to allow those animals on designated trails, much the way horses are. As noted earlier, we want to clarify that or expand our prohibition on the introduction of exotic species. Currently, it is prohibited to introduce fish into the waters of a state park. We want to expand that to include all species of animals because that we feel that, you know, we are having more and more issues with invasive and exotic species, and this would allow us another tool to address that issue. We would also like to amend the current language to accommodate bow fishing and archery events. Those uses are sort of implied under current law. But again, clarity is our goal here. So I wanted to make it clear that you can participate in bow fishing in a state park and not be in violation of our rules about display of weapons. And then update the rules to be in compliance with recently passed legislation about the display of firearms. Okay. Seem to end right there, but there are two chapters that are proposed for repeal. Here we go. The first is relocation assistance in park acquisition projects. This section was established back in the late 1990s, I believe, during the development of the World Birding Center. It was really something that was put in to address a specific situation. Staff doesn't really feel like this is liable to come up again. And so we just propose that this be deleted. And then also, as noted earlier, subchapter K, which addresses the donation of donated lands, that was largely moved into the subchapter C and expanded to cover all park acquisitions, not just donations of land. With that, I will close. And if you have any questions or comments, I will try to address those. And obviously, this was a very high-level, quick overview of these changes. The process took a lot longer to do than to make this presentation. But if you'd like to visit on any of the specifics of this, I'll be glad to do that now or in the future.
Thank you. Any questions for Kevin?
Sure, Doug. I've got a couple of suggested tweaks to the language. We can talk about it after.
Great. Be happy to.
So no further discussion. I'll authorize staff to publish proposed rules in the Texas Register for the required public comment period. Thank you.
Thank you.
With regard to work session item number 8, land acquisition, Matagorda County, approximately 6,554 acres on the Matagorda Peninsula, does any commissioner have any questions or comments concerning that item? Hearing none, I will place this item on the Thursday commission meeting agenda for public comment and action. With regard to work session item number 9, grant of utility easement, Brazoria County, approximately 0.4 acres at the Justin Hurst Wildlife Management Area. Does any commissioner have any questions or comments? Hearing none, I will place this item on the Thursday commission meeting agenda for public comment and action. We're rocking and rolling here. Work session item number 10, grant of utility easement, Brazoria County, approximately 37 acres at the Justin Hurst Wildlife Management Area. This item was previously withdrawn, which brings us to our mystery guest, who's going to present work session item number 11, boundary agreement including exchange of real estate, Presidio County, Big Bend Ranch State Park, request permission to begin the public notice and input process.
Who are you?
Please identify yourself.
Chairman, commissioners, good afternoon. My name is Ted Hollingsworth. I'm with the Land Conservation Program. This item regards Big Bend National Park out in West Texas. I think most of y'all know where that is in the Big Bend country, south of Marfa. More or less adjacent to the Big Bend National Park, adjacent to a couple of large protected areas across the river in Mexico. It is our largest state park by far, approximately 310,000 acres. We've been building that park since 1988 when we acquired the first 212-acre tract. We have about 22 miles of frontage on the Rio Grande River and more than 100 miles of boundary in common with adjacent landowners. As you can imagine, civil survey is very complex. The park is comprised of many parcels of land, many of which have not been surveyed for a variety of reasons. And there were fences in that country that were there before we purchased that property, and those fences are fences of convenience. They've been put where fences can be put. A lot of areas out there, because of the substrate, because of the topography, just don't lend themselves to fences. And so with a number of our neighbors, we actually have agreements that we understand that the fences are not on the boundaries, that we own to our boundary, the neighbor owns to the boundary, doesn't necessarily mean it's where the fence is. It's an open range county, which means that the owners of cattle don't have to keep their cattle fenced in. If you want cattle not on your property, you have to keep them fenced out. And so as a result, we do have boundary agreements with a number of our neighbors. There is a ranch that's adjacent to the stovepipe, or the northern part of the park, on the east side of the stovepipe, called the LaMota Ranch. The family that owns that ranch donated over 13,000 acres of that ranch in 2000. We have about 18 miles of boundary in common with that LaMota Ranch. And they've recently added land, and I've gone to a considerable expense to survey that common boundary between their ranch and the state park. And as a result, we can now propose to straighten that boundary out. This shows the general location of that ranch on the east side of the stovepipe. But we have an opportunity to straighten that boundary out, and if we do that, a tract that's now part of the park would become part of the LaMota Ranch. A tract, or two tracts, that are part of the LaMota Ranch would become part of Big Bend Ranch State Park. It would shorten that boundary by almost 5 miles and would add almost 600 acres to the state park. It would also add, and I think this is very significant, it would add frontage on that county road that includes the best road into what we call the Cienega portion. About 15,000 acres of the state park, the scenic portion of the state park. Again, that boundary of that to east-west, I'm sorry, that north-south boundary would be shortened from 10 miles to 5.2 miles. we would net add approximately 578 acres to the state park, and we would gain a good access road into the Cienega portion of the Big Bend Ranch State Park. We believe that this is a very good transaction that makes a lot of sense for both parties. We have a very willing landowner who's worked very closely with us. We do have a team of archaeologists on the ground this week, in fact, to study that common boundary. The landowner has agreed to fence around any archaeological resources that are discovered and has agreed to fence inside his boundary line by a few feet in order to ensure that he doesn't fence in any state park property. We have a very good working relationship going and a rare opportunity to clean up what can be a very convoluted boundary line in that country, and we'll end up with a fenced common boundary, which is probably the exception rather than the rule at Big Bend Ranch. So staff does recommend that you grant us permission to begin the public notice and input process for this one. Be happy to answer any questions.
A great opportunity.
Mm-hmm. Yes, ma'am.
That's great.
Is there any further questions or comments? All right, I'll authorize staff to begin the public notice and input process. With regard to work session item number 12, acceptance of land donation, Cameron County, in holdings totaling approximately 15 acres at Boca Chica State Park, does any commissioner have any questions or comments? Hearing none, I will place this item on the Thursday Commission meeting agenda for public comment and action. Let's see, work session item number 13. Land sale, Brown County, approximately 19 acres at the Muse Wildlife Management Area. Request permission to begin the public notice and input process. Mr. Corky Kuhlman, welcome.
Good afternoon, commissioners. For the record, Corky Kuhlman with the Land Conservation Program. This is a request for a land sale in Brown County at the Muse Wildlife Management Area, located just northeast of Brownwood. Generally, we're here to talk about acquiring land, and we work really hard to acquire land, and sometimes it makes sense for us to dispose of some land, which, you know, happens at times. The Muse consists of 1,972 acres. It is a very typical wildlife management area used to develop wildlife habitat and protect the native habitat and wildlife species, provide demonstration areas to the public, and also provide public hunting opportunities to the public. In this case, the Muse was donated to Parks and Wildlife. There was a small tract, as you can see on this slide, about 19 acres, that's across the county road from the rest of the management area. The 19 acres across the county road is difficult to manage. We have a lot of trouble with vandalism, trespass, littering, dumping of trash, and this takes away a lot from the staff time trying to keep track of that small track. We put up gates. People tear them down. We've had gates that's only lasted a couple of weeks, tear them down to get in. They know that that the site isn't policed that much. It's a kind of a far ways away from the headquarters, opposite end of the headquarters of that management area. What we were proposed to do is to offer to sell the 19 acres to one of two adjacent landowners. In the deed restrictions that Parks and Wildlife got when we got the land, it says it must be managed in perpetuity by a wildlife management plan provided by Parks and Wildlife. If one of the two adjacent neighbors chose to buy it, then there would be a plan put in place by Parks and Wildlife and managed by that plan in perpetuity, and that would include no building of any kind allowed. We would reserve all mineral rights on the property, which we own the mineral rights. I don't know if I have a slide to show it. I don't. There is a small adobe pit on the site. We're going to ask whoever buys it to rejuvenate and put back into native, put soil on it and put it back in the native vegetation. I'll be glad to answer any questions.
You said it's a small adobe what?
I'm sorry, Caliche Pit.
Caliche Pit.
Sorry about that. I was in the wrong part of the world.
I'm sorry.
Any other questions or comments? I will place this item on the Thursday Commission meeting agenda for public comment and action. With regard to work session item number 15, acceptance of land donation, Bexar County, approximately 232 acres at Government Canyon State Natural Area, request permission to begin public notice and input process. Does any commissioner have any questions or comments about that work session item? Hearing none, I'll authorize staff to begin the public notice and input process. Number 16, be heard in executive session 17 and executive session 18. Did I skip one? Oop. I beg your pardon. Sorry, Corky. I skipped over
14.
With regard to work session item number 14, land acquisition, Cochran County, approximately 5 acres at Yoakum Dunes Wildlife Management Area. Does any commissioner have any questions or comments about that prospective land acquisition? Hearing none, I'll place that item on the Thursday Commission meeting agenda for public comment and action. Now, returning to items 16, 17, and 18, each of those will be heard in executive session. So at this time,
Commissioner, could I clarify something quickly? With regard to item number 13, which is the Muse Wildlife Management Area, what we would request is that staff begin the public notice and input process, and we won't bring that back to the commission until January at the earliest. So that one won't be heard tomorrow.
Okay. Any objections from any commissioner to that? Okay. So done.
Thank you.
So approved, whatever. Now can we go into executive session?
Yes, sir.
All right. I've gotten my clearance.
I think he's
hungry. Yeah.
Let me ask counsel. Bill, are you okay?
I'm good. I'm hungry.
All right. So at this time, pursuant to the requirements of Chapter 551 of the Texas Government Code, known to everyone as the Open Meetings Act, an executive session will be held at this time for the purpose of, number one, seeking legal advice under Section 551.071, of the Open Meetings Act, including advice regarding pending or contemplated litigation. Number two, deliberating the evaluation of personnel under Section 551.074 of the Texas Open Meetings Act. Number three, deliberating regarding the duties and reassignment of public employees under Section 551.074 of the Texas Open Meetings Act. And lastly, deliberating the deployment and specific occasions for implementation of security personnel or devices under Section 551.076 of the Texas Open Meetings Act. We will now recess for that executive session.
Okay. We will now reconvene the regular session of the work session on November 4th, 2015 at 3 and change. I can't, no. 322. At 322. With regard to work session item number 16, Texas-Mexico border security and deployment of department personnel, Operation Strong Safety, no further action is required at this time. With regard to work session 17, update on regulatory litigation, no further action is required at this time. And finally, regarding work session item 14, personnel matters, no further action is required at this time. Mr. Smith, this commission has completed its work session business, and I declare us adjourned.